Welcome back to We Got Goosebumps, a podcast dedicated to the landmark horror series for children, written by R.L. Stine back in the 90s. I'm your overweight prankster Uncle Dylan. I didn't think he was overweight. I thought he was like
He was pronounced as being very overweight, and I'm your cringy and annoying cousin that you still want to impress for some strange reason. I'm Travis, and I'm just getting over a bit of the crud, Dylan, so just to let our listeners know that sometimes I can get deep, deep down in these mummified registers, which will be perfect for today's episode.
I missed the overweight part. I just, every time they describe, and now in retrospect, that's a little silly because there's thousands of scenes where he's like, had to squeeze through. But I always just imagine him as like a big guy, like kind of me in terms of height, but not me in terms of muscle mass. Like I just pictured like, it's fine. I just have to change what I think of when I look at. Okay, we're good. Aside from my digression, today we're talking about the fifth book in Goosebumps, The Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, which was released in January of 1993. So we have finally left 1992. Goodbye, 1992.
We did it.
So I don't know anything about 1993, and I don't think you do either. Because we've never had to live back in that year. We're going to be talking to everybody about the plot of the book very shortly. But, you know, Travis, did you ever wander off as a kid and get lost or separated or end up inspiring John Walsh to create a program that helps capture wanted fugitives? That's a dark joke.
No,
I don't know if I want to answer
that. It is. It is. Well, no, it's history. It's history. They never did find that kid, Adam Walsh. But you know what? Or did they?
Nah. They did. They did.
Well, hopefully they do.
They found about 70% of Adam Walsh.
Well, that still counts. So,
but no, yeah, I'm not saying they didn't find him. I'm just saying, to be honest, this book does kind of talk on those kind of themes. I mean, not as dark as that, but...
Yeah, it's only lighter from here, folks. And you know what? I did get separated or lost as a kid memorably one time. I was very small, well, maybe like five, and I got separated from my dad in Walmart because I was ogling the trapper keepers too hard. I was like, man, I got to get me a trapper keeper. And my dad, he had taken off to the sewing section because my mom needed some thread or yarn or something, and he had wandered off back there. And I was like, oh, no, I lost my dad. And I went back to the sewing section, and I talked to the lady there in the back, and I was like, I think I lost my dad. And she had to get it on the speaker, and she was like, what was your dad's name? And I was like, his name is James. And she called him over the speaker, and he came to the back to get me. And we were probably separated for about 3 minutes. But it felt to me like, this is it. This is probably it. So after that, I was... not allowed to ogle near the trapper keepers for too long. And then there was another time, Dylan, this one kind of harkens more closely to the narrative that we're going to be talking about today. I remember it was my cousin's birthday, many, many, many years ago. I think I was probably, I don't know, in the neighborhood of 9 years old. He was probably eight. And, we went on a trail because his birthday party was at like a lake. And, we went walking on this trail that we all swore looped. We swore this thing looped. We thought for sure it went around the lake. That's what that trail does. There's no maps. It was called Lake Trail. Well, it must go around the lake. I can see the other side of the lake. We'll be home in an hour. No, we walked and walked and walked, and then we got terribly lost because we were like, well, no point in going back now. We know that was a really long walk. Maybe our rescue is a short walk. And we found a family who drove us back. And we had walked like 6 miles.
That is terrifying.
It was rough. Yeah. And we also, it was me and my cousin, but it was also his mom, and she was pushing a baby stroller. And it was only meant to be a short walk. Ended up being a really long walk. Could have needed some survival for a small child. Yeah, it worked out, though.
Yeah, that's getting worse and worse and worse.
We're mountain folk. We're not smart. We just like lakes and trails.
As a child, no, not really. I was never a wandering child or a loose child. I usually stuck pretty close to familiar to familiar ground. To this day, in fact, I'm pretty bad about, if I wander too far out of my comfort zone, I will immediately get lost. It's kind of like someone who's never gotten sick before and they finally get the cold and then, like, they have no immune defenses. If I get lost, I'm dead. There's no way I'm getting out of there.
Oh, man.
Because I stick to, like, about a 10-block radius around where I live. And that's good enough for me. And occasionally we'll go to woods.
You know what's weird? I like being lost. It kind of charges me up. I dig it.
I'm fine knowing that other people might get lost looking for me, but I don't want to be lost myself. Like, I want to be like the kid in My Side of the Mountain. I want to be like Sam and live in my tree and have a hawk. Did you not read that book as a child?
I think I did. Was it called Sam Hawk?
No, it's called My Side of the Mountain. You probably weren't as interested in reading that book because that actually was your childhood, which is...
So. Yeah, we didn't read biographies growing up. We read interesting stories about, what's the name of that book? Something about Dolphin's Cove. Anyway, the...
I think the same guy wrote that book, actually. My sense of direction is absolutely the worst. Like, when I went to Toronto a couple months, I almost said that with a very bad Canadian accent. I'm glad I was able to cut that off. When I went back to Toronto, PNP can tell you I got lost walking back to the car after having parked it there for 10 minutes.
That's not good.
It'd been parked for 10 minutes, and then walking back to it was difficult.
That's not great.
No, it's
pretty bad.
I hope
you get that fixed.
Every episode, I reveal something about myself that makes it more and more likely that I'm going to be kidnapped and lost forever. Because last episode, I believe I revealed that I believe what everyone says to me. Like, I don't believe in guile. Like, I just take everyone's word for it.
You're handsome and you're good at podcasting.
No, because we haven't even started talking about the cover.
Ah, let's get to the cover then, shall we? Do you have fascinations with pyramids or mummies or anything like that?
I know this is going to come as a shock to you, but I recently became very interested in burial rituals, specifically around vampirism. There's a very interesting book about how the author believes that, like, the thought of vampirism arose in early cultures. And he also talked a lot about, like, the burial rites that arose around this. And it's very interesting how the same kind of ideas repeat across the, like, I talked to someone who was from China originally, and he was telling me about, we have the story that, like, if an animal jumps over a dead body, it can come back to life, and it becomes like this, the vampire, not really a vampire, but sort of the same kind of thing is in Europe. Like, if you go to Europe, they believe that if, like, a black dog or a black cat jumps over a corpse, that's one way that it could be revived from the dead as an undead monster.
That is interesting. Well, mummies certainly have their own birth rituals involved. Burial rituals involved. I don't think mummies are born very often. At least not as mummies. Have you had a cousin who bullied you constantly? Because, gosh dang, Dylan, the cousin in this book is one of the worst people ever written.
I have a lot of, like, second cousins and third cousins and fifth cousins twice removed. I only have two main cousins, and I was older than both of them by considerable margins. So, no, they did not.
And they still bullied you. Oh, no. Okay. I had a cousin who was a year older than me, and I don't know if he bullied me, but he just bigger and bodied me a lot. You know, I think at the end of the day, he'd have looked after me and been a big brother when it counted. But, most of the time, you know, when it did come to mischief, sometimes he was the one urging me to break the rules a little bit. Like, come on, sneak up here at this family reunion. We're getting my dad's truck. I know we're only 6 and 5, but my dad's got Natty Light in there. Let's go. And I remember taking a big hit off that Natty Light and being like, this is honestly the grossest thing I've ever drank. I don't know why adults are just hanging around doing this. So I got bullied into my first beer at 5 years old.
Oh, wait, that was a true story.
Yeah, of course it was. I don't lie. Not on this podcast.
Oh, boy.
Well, I just drank one.
All right. You just drank one Natty Light at 5 years old.
It wasn't bad. I mean, it was awful. But, I mean, it wasn't bad that I drank just one. It wasn't like I went home and started beating the dog and begging for beer. I was fine.
I like that. That's the scale of escalation.
I did become a NASCAR fan immediately after.
I like that. That's the scale of escalation for you. It's just like, You drink one Natty Light, then you're drinking a six pack, then you're beating your dog, then you're a NASCAR fan. Like, that's the order. Like, beating your dog, NASCAR fan.
Pretty much. Okay, so you didn't bully your cousins. You didn't let them bully you. But I'll tell you what, the cover of this gosh dang thing. I have opinions, Dylan.
You know what? I actually have a copy of the book. I mean, let's be honest. All the copies of the book I have because of you. But yeah, I've got the...
Yeah.
This is the retrofit, right? The first retrofit?
Yeah, you got the 2008 edition. Or I'm sorry, 2003 edition. I have the 1993 edition. And by a dish, I am meaning to say edition, folks at home. The cover is it's a mummy. It's wrapped in very thin mummy wrappings. I don't know that they go that thin. Dylan, I'm no mummyologist, if that's what you might call one. But I feel like they're wrapped in thicker ply, or a wider ply. This looks like shoelaces.
I think it's difficult to get the band, because if you go too wide, it's going to look stupid. You know, if like it'll look like a Scooby-Doo mummy where you don't even have overlapping straps. It's literally just a man colored white with lines going across him vertically. And that's it looks silly. This might have gone too far the other direction, but I think it looks creepier than if they'd been broader. Like, I think the thinner bandage was the right way to go. It certainly made more work for himself. Like, this is an amazing amount of detail on what is a very static image. Like, this could be the bust of a mummy. Like, a mummy statue that stops right at the chest, and he's just in front of a, again, very well-detailed stone wall.
Yeah, I get what you mean. A lot of detail, not a lot of action, no movement, no threat, really, other than the red eyes that emanate from the mummy's face. I do agree, though. I mean, I guess I was knocking it a little bit. I do think the detail of the strands that are going around him there is pretty impressive. I think I'd have doubled the width. That would have made me happy. I think that'd have been a good compromise for you as well. And right there, the little tagline, we say, it says, "What will wake the dead? What will wake the dead?" And we'll get to that for sure.
Yeah.
As far as covers go, I don't know. For the ones that we've done so far, I don't know that you can top Say Cheese and Die. This is probably of our first five here. It's ranking at number five for me. It's my least favorite.
Yeah, it's funny how this cover compares. So I would say that out of all the books, the least interesting, not interesting, I don't want to be mean about it. I would say, like, you have Say Cheese and Die, which is Skeletons Having a Barbecue. Like, just knocked out. It is so far ahead at that point, you know, like...
So good.
You can't even really compare it to what came before it. It's Skeletons Having a Barbecue.
Amazing.
You have Monster Blood, with the Monster Blood going down the stairs, and the spectacles.
Drippity drip.
Ominous. Terrifying as an adult. Don't understand how that runner ran. That doesn't make sense. That carpet runner
doesn't make sense.
You have...
Will it get clean?
The stay out of the basement. The hand coming out of the door.
The hand.
And then you have The Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, which is, aside from the glow-up eyes, and you know what? I have a skeleton on my back porch with red glow-up eyes, but it's made of plastic. Red glowing eyes don't scare me, because it makes me think of giant skeletons I bought at CVS 50% markdown on November 1st.
Yeah.
But then you have the house cover, where... Welcome to the house. The two different covers, I feel like those covers are very similar in that they feel very old school, kind of universal horror monster pictures kind of movie. Like, they feel very old school, and the house beats the mummy. Like, the cover of the house, which is literally just a cover of a house, beats the picture of this cover for me, which is the cover of a monster. If this is literally a monster that could kill you and eat you.
Yeah.
And I'd rather see the house. I would rather see the house.
Maybe it needed a mouth. And you know what does have a mouth? If you flip over to this 2009, the latest refresh of the cover, which I believe is also drawn by Tim Jacobus. I couldn't find sources to say otherwise. I like this one a little bit more. It's a mummy with its arms outstretched, as you imagine mummies to be, curled up fingers, seems to be pretty, you know, dilapidated torso, sunken in, probably no meat on the bones anymore. You can see the mouth open, some gnarly teeth. The glowing eyes are still there, coming at you through a tomb. A lot more threatening, a lot more interesting to look at. I don't really like a lot of the newer covers at all, but this one, I do favor over the original.
I don't know if I like this either. I poke around some... Oh, I just got to England. Or the United Kingdom. I'm sorry. It's not all England's fault. This is Ireland, you know, like part of Ireland. You're in there too, Scotland, Wales. All of you guys, get in here. This is your fault. It is...
Yeah.
It's a mummy swimming its way out of strawberry jam. That's what this is.
It's like nipple soup.
It
There's like
is
so
too.
Many.
I didn't want to say that, but they do look... It looks like breasts.
Like, yeah.
So many.
Like
so
implants.
Many boobies.
Yeah, it's... We get to see a bit of a face, at least, underneath. It's a green face with red lipstick.
But that looks like that might just be, like, Uncle Ben under there, you know? Like, that looks like someone who's just like, I'm going to pretend to be a mummy, and he colored his face green, and now he fell into the rhubarb pudding, or whatever that is.
Yeah.
I don't understand these covers. One of these days, we're going to have to look it up and be like, well, the publisher was confused in England and thought that Goosebumps was boysenberry jam, and so every cover is just jams.
And no one thought to stop him for 7 years. The French cover is interesting. A skeletized, maybe you would say, mummy coming up out of an actual coffin. Just kind of neat. I would say a lot of international ones aren't as interesting as they usually are. But I got to tell you, man, the frickin', what is it? The Dutch are still on their Babysitter's Club bend. And the Dutch don't shy away from letting you know that everyone in Deutschland, everyone there is white and blonde. Everybody there.
I do love this cover because I don't think the artist has actually knows what a mummy is, and he had to have someone describe it to him, and this is what he drew. Because those look like ropes. It looks like... I don't know what that is, but that is not a mummy, and I think that's why I like this cover the most. It's the only one without a mummy on it, and that's why it's the best cover. So this is my favorite out of a...
Yeah, let's touch on that a bit before we get into the meat of the meat here. You don't like mummies all that much.
I don't ever find them scary in any way, shape, or form. I can't get past... for me, growing up, my first introduction to horror was the Universal Monster movies, like, with Wolfman and Invisible Man, and I didn't really like Frankenstein either. I don't like those big, lumbery, slow monsters, like Frankenstein's monster. I get yelled at, or The Mummy. But, like, I stayed away from The Mummy. I owned it, but that was the one I watched the least. I was always about the Wolfman, because I loved werewolves and the vampires and the Draculas, those are great, but the mummy, and there's no risk. Like, just don't go in the pyramid. It's kind of like, you know, don't go to Crystal Lake. Jason won't cut you up. Don't go inside the tomb and steal a bunch of artifacts from another country, and then maybe you won't get cursed. It's a very easy thing to avoid, which is why I don't particularly find mummies scary. If the protagonist has to get lost inside the Great Pyramids of Giza, then it's not really something I have to worry about, necessarily.
Yeah, I find them more interesting than scary. I'll agree with you on that. All right, let's freaking open this crock pot and get in this soup, huh? Let's do it. All right. So, chapter one here. We're going to lay out some characters. We got Gabe. Our main guy, Gabe, Gabriel, our guy, his mom and dad, and they're on a trip to Egypt because, as we alluded to just moments ago, Gabe's ancestors were Egyptian. His Uncle Ben lives there, and he's got a cousin, Sari. Is it Sari or Sari? How are you going with that? Are you going Sari on that?
I'm going with the audiobook pronounced as Sari.
Sari. All right, let's go with Sari. Uncle Ben, he's an archaeologist, so heading on out to Egypt. Seems like, I was a little jealous when I read that, because I was like, man, I wish I had family that lived anywhere other than Virginia that I could go visit.
Family, bud. You can always come up to see me.
Okay, Uncle Dylan. I might take you up on that. I might somehow convince my wife to convince my daughter. You know what? I'll make you godfather. How about that? You're my daughter's godfather. Now okay. I can come visit you.
That means I get her if you die, right?
Yep. Free daughter.
And that's how I got a child. I felt like every now and then R.L. Stine's joke writing background pops up, because the explanation for why mom and dad are in Egypt is that they're actually on a business trip and they sell refrigeration units and they're in Egypt. And I'm sure that was 100% a gag.
It's hot there. I hear it's hot. You know, let's go to Egypt anyway. Now, earlier you led off this podcast by mentioning Uncle Ben was a heavier guy, overweight. And I hope I didn't conflate that with Dad, who is clearly described as fat. Dad is clearly described as being a hefty boy. And I don't know that it's really necessary for R.L. Stine to put these things in here other than to make it relatable for kids who read the books. Be like, hey, my dad's also fat. This is like a fat dad. I got a fat dad.
There was a bit more fat shaming in this one. Like, before it was more just like, that book... It was not told from the perspective of the kids, so it was the narrator being like, "That dad's a little fat and he's running right, has to catch his breath." But in this one, it's the son who's just like, "Dad's really sensitive about his weight, so I make sure to bring it up at every opportunity." It's like, "You little shit, Gabe! Like, don't do that to someone. That's just mean."
I just flipped by and found that exact paragraph. Just kidding, I said, "Dad's a little sensitive about his weight, so I try to tease him about it as often as I can." Like, okay, way to go.
To be fair, we find out that this family is pretty awful, at least his uncle and his cousin. So maybe the whole family is just wicked awful to him. Like, his mom is a little mean to him. She's like, "Hey, mom, I'm a 12-year-old in the desert for the first time. I'm thirsty." And she's like, "Shut up, I'm staring at this pyramid. I'm sure something's going to happen at some point. Like, it's going to jump. I want to take your eyes off that pyramid."
Gabe is whiny that he's thirsty. His parents don't really seem to care. But, you know, he wants to check out the inside of the Great Pyramid with his Uncle Ben, who is an archaeologist who has access to the inside of a pyramid, which is a lucky thing to have. Not many people are allowed in there, Dylan. You know, they're not sending tons of folks through the bowels of the pyramids. If your uncle could go in there, I would try to bribe my uncle to get me in there. I don't want to lay my eyes on some stuff.
100%. My grandmother was friends with a woman who worked at a zoo. You know what she did? Got to go see behind the scenes at the zoo.
Oh, wow. Got to see the animals that they didn't trot out in front of the public. The freak animals in the back. Do they keep spare parts in the back?
I got to pet a rhinoceros and an elephant, my friend. Just right on his horn. Yeah.
How'd that go? Pretty good?
Yeah, it was good. It was
awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, Dad deflates Gabe's pyramid and tells him, you're not really allowed to go inside the pyramid, but Gabe, he still has those Indiana Jones fantasies. So that's our setup. Gabe really wants to go into a pyramid. His family is mostly fat and annoying, and he's thirsty. Dum, dum, dum.
I want to say that the first chapter of an R.L. Stine child is the hardest chapter to get through. For whatever reason, he always introduces these children in the worst possible way. Like, literally out of the gate, we get Gabe being like, "I'm thirsty!" And like, I always do the audiobook, and I got to hear the guy like, really, "But Mom!" And just like, ugh. Same with Evan in Monster Blood. Same with Josh in Welcome to Dead House. Like, I keep talking about the B book because that's the only one I skipped ahead and read, because I'm like, I'm not going to skip ahead and read the other ones, but I'm gonna read the B book in a little bit. I was turned into a bee, I think is the name of the title. Mm. But the first chapter is him just being like, "I'm scared of everything and I hate my life." Just, boy, God, I hope nothing bad happens to you. Like, it's. And then usually after that, they're fine. I don't know if he just needs to get out of a system like, "I hate children secretly." But we get, like, we're moving into the second chapter, we do get into the, like, start to humanize Gabe a little bit, so he's not just the whiny child who calls his dad fat and just cares more about drinking water than seeing a pyramid. That's not really a bad thing. I think drinking water is a good thing.
That's like, not terrible.
He's got his Cocker Spaniel.
Yes, another Cocker Spaniel. I think we're four for four.
I missed the part. I think this is our fourth Cocker Spaniel. There's been one Cocker Spaniel a book, except for the first one. And that book was just described as indescribable. It was like a Lovecraftian nightmare of a dog or something. But they're just like, you know, it's that kind of dog. I missed the part where they said that Elvis was a Cocker Spaniel. And when at some point in the chapter, the mom gets a phone call and he's just like, I hope it's not about Elvis. I hope Elvis didn't die. And she's like, when was this book set? And then it's like, it's probably a dog.
Yeah, 1970s is when this one was set.
That would have been perfect if this was set in the 70s. That would have just changed the whole thing up for me. But
yeah,
the call that she does get is sending them to his parents, once again, are on a business trip. This isn't actually to see Uncle Ben and Sari. This is for them to sell refrigeration units in the desert. And they get a call that they need to go to Alexandria. But Gabe wants to stay in Cairo, hang out with Uncle Ben, get to the bottom of this pyramid, literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
But there's kind of a mini dun-dun-dun in this chapter, because Uncle Ben is super awesome. We love Uncle Ben. But then his mom drops a bomb about who's staying home.
Yeah, and it's that
Christmas vacation. Because this is Christmas time. That's the other thing. This is a Christmas book.
Yeah, that's right, which is interesting. Christmas in the desert. And gosh dang.
That's how Jesus had it.
That's how
Jesus had it.
Okay. I forget you know so much about that. Yeah, it's unfortunately Uncle Ben's stuck-up daughter. You know, Uncle Ben would have been cool, but unfortunately, this dastardly, evil, conniving, teasing, overbearing, obnoxious daughter of his, sorry, Gabe's cousin, will also be there. And it's S-A-R-I, sorry. And also, it sounds like the word sorry, as if she's a sorry excuse for a good kid, because she's awful. She's an awful child. Dylan may agree that she might be the worst child, even with the bullies that we encounter in two books consecutive, she may be the worst.
Her parents are smart in naming her sorry, because then she just apologizes as she introduces herself. So you know ahead of time, this is a problem.
So Uncle Ben's cool. He gets to hang out with her. So that's a bit of a trade-off. Good news, bad news there. But at least he doesn't have to go to Alexandria to sell refrigeration units with his corny parents. He gets to hang out with his uncle. But in order to do this trade-off, and apparently this important meeting in Alexandria is so important that they just have to leave their son behind in a hotel room by himself. And Uncle Ben's going to be a little bit, so he has to stay in a hotel room by himself for about an hour so they could go catch their plane, and he's going to wait for Uncle Ben to come by the room. He's got to wait there, wait for a knock at the door.
Question for you, because...
Yeah.
You and I grew up, we were children in this time, and in 93 I was 13, so we're about the age. How many times were you left? Oh, I would spend 8 hours at a time by myself.
Yeah.
But they're acting as just like, Gabe, are you going to be okay in this hotel room for a single hour? And he's just like, I don't know. I'm going to try though, mama, for you. Like, I understand it's a hotel and it's a foreign country and everything, but like, you just stay in your room.
Yeah, you should be fine.
And it's a hotel room. There's nothing more exciting than a hotel room when you're a child.
I know.
Even if you're in, like, Egypt, I would be all about, like, I'm going to search every drawer. I found a Bible in one of these drawers. There's bound to be, like, hidden treasure in some of these other drawers. Because I didn't understand that Bibles just appear naturally in hotels. So, as a child, I was just like, a free book. Gotta be more.
Yeah, no, just that one. And yeah, I would have probably been, you know, surfing the Skinamax and whatever, you know, whatever I could get for my hour. I agree. It's, you know, as long as he stays in the room, he's safe. But maybe the hesitation is, you know, foreign country, hotel room, maybe, you know, if something happens to Uncle Ben, what's he going to do? I don't know. But yeah, it seemed to be a big deal. Also, Gabe admittedly scared of being alone. So to comfort himself, he pulls out his lucky mummy hand. And that's not a euphemism. It's a lucky mummy hand. He found it for $2 at a garage sale, which is a pretty good find. You know, I search and search garage sales pretty regularly, Dylan. And had I find a, you know, if I find a lucky mummy hand, I mean, that's coming home with me. I think that's a good get. That was a good get in 1993, mm-hmm. apparently. It would have been a great get right here today. But he's able to grab that for $2, and he bought it from another kid who sold it to him. And he said, no, that's this right here that I'm selling you for $2, this mummy hand. Now, that's a summoner. I call that a summoner. And he said, okay, I just kind of wanted it because it was cool. He takes it and puts it in his pocket. So he pulls it out here now to help himself feel safe. And suddenly, the hotel room door opens, and which I'm going to pause right here and say that shouldn't happen.
No, the whole time this was happening, the whole time this was happening, I was just like, why is the door, like, I felt like I missed something. I, like, rewound it several times because I thought I had missed something that explained why his hotel door was unlocked. It was a big mystery for me. But I guess Gabe is just not very bright, and maybe that's why they're concerned about leaving him alone and why he's afraid to be alone. He's like, Gabe, just lock the door. He's like,
He just leaves it open.
You gotta roll the dice and see what happens, Mom. I leave the front door unlocked, and I don't wear a seatbelt. Those are my two vices. It's like, all right.
I like to jump out of moving cars, which will come up later. Yeah. He had his shoe wedged in between the door. He's like, it can't shut. I'll suffocate. And so the door, okay, now we're back to the moment. Suddenly, you know, he's in there. He's holding that lucky mummy hand. He's a little bit scared. He's already surfed through the Skinamax. He's exhausted the catalog. Suddenly, the hotel room door opens, and he is startled. Now, Uncle Ben would have knocked, he thinks, but uh-oh, in walks a mummy with big glowing eyes. Dum, dum, dum!
All right. So it is Uncle Ben. So clearly, Uncle Ben, no, we're not relieved. We're angry right now. Like, this is the start of the bullshit in this book right here, sir. Although this is pretty funny. I'll give Uncle Ben this. If you're gonna put in the effort to frighten a 12-year-old, go all out. Like, yeah. Don't be lazy about it. Because children are easy targets to scare. Like,
oh,
you
sure.
can just boo them. And they'll be like, ah. So, like, don't just punch down. Punch down with style. Right? Like, really get the band, like, use real. I bet you Ben got real linen bandages from another mummy and just like, just wrap me up. We're gonna go for authenticity, put a couple of teeth in there, we'll be good to rock and roll.
Somewhere there's very cold, naked mummy, and he's like, taking this off you, I gotta scare a boy later.
Which just frightened the mummy more than anyone would be frightened of the mummy. But Gabe whips his mummy hand at the mummy because that's how you stop a mummy. That's the other problem with mummies. What's the way you defeat, like, as a child, silver kills werewolves, holy water crosses, vampires, like, anything could kill a vampire. Like, except
garlic.
For, like,
yeah.
guns. Yeah, like, they don't like garlic, they don't like sunlight, they sound like nerds. I don't mean in the sense that they sound like nerds, but I feel like if you just listed all the things that vampires can't do, you would be like, I feel like I could just push one over. Like, they can't eat garlic. They have to be invited inside. They can't cross running water. What is wrong with them? Do they have phobias? They just sound like they're very neurotic.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm not afraid of a vampire, to be honest.
That's actually true. In old myths, they believed that you could scatter small seeds on the ground and it would distract a vampire because they would have to count every seed. Or they would bury vampires with knots because it would have to untie every single knot before it could attack. So they did think that vampires were actually neurotic. I'm sorry. I'm going to be doing this a lot because I'm on my fourth cup of coffee.
Okay.
Where are we, though? We're with Uncle Ben in a hotel room.
Yeah, how do you stop a mummy? You were working your way up to that, I think.
How do you stop a mummy? There is no way to stop a mummy.
I think they're flammable.
Wow. I feel like that was 10 minutes ago that I started that sentence, and now we've come back to the beginning of the sentence, which is not how sentences work.
It was a while. Yeah, I would think that they're flammable. Well, Gabe throws his mummy hand at him, and all this does is make Uncle Ben laugh a lot, because that is hilarious. A scared boy throws a decrepit, small, tchotchke hand at your face. That's funny. And, well, they all settle down, and Uncle Ben tells him that he's recently discovered an area of a pyramid It's unexplored.
Right. Wait, you forgot to mention Sari, that she's there too.
Well, Sari's there too.
She's like, yeah.
And she's an asshole, and she makes fun of him for getting scared. Yeah, she's a real pain.
Which leads to problems later, because then he starts doing stupid stuff so that they don't make fun of him.
Yeah. She is the worst. Yeah, I left that out. Thank you, Dylan. Yeah, she's there just to amplify Gabe's embarrassment for being a little bit scared because somebody broke into his hotel room in this foreign country and tried to eat him. Normal thing to be scared about, but sorry, was an asshole about it. But anyway, after they all settle down, Uncle Ben, he's recently discovered an area of a pyramid unexplored for thousands of years, and that's pretty cool. And he's like, listen, I'll be taking you guys there, Gabe and Sari, because, there's nowhere else for you to go. I'm like, well, I don't know that they just let you do that. I don't think they just let you drag kids into your pyramid. I don't know. I found that interesting, but Gabe's pretty stoked about it, even though Sari has to go. I think Sari's already been in there. She probably admits that later. She's already seen it. So nothing impresses her. She's too cool for school. And another thing that bothers me, they go out for dinner. They go to a restaurant there in Cairo, and their orders are a club sandwich and a hamburger. I don't know why that bothered me so much. I'm like, you when in Rome, you get do what the Romans do. Yeah, similarly for Egypt.
Yeah, there's got to be food on the menu. Like, I feel like Uncle Ben's just like, I'm not dealing with this nonsense of trying to find stuff that these two American children want to eat. I'm going to find the closest American-esque place, and we're getting sandwiches. Uncle Ben does not seem like a good parent. Before they go in, Uncle Ben's like, there might be a curse. But he specifically mentions that there's one guy in his crew that's like always bothering him about this curse, that there's a curse in the thing, and a curse and a curse and a curse and a curse. Yada yada yada. And of course, this is again, Uncle Ben should not be a parent. Uncle Ben should just be an uncle.
Yeah.
That is Uncle Ben's role. He should not be in charge of a child for longer than a weekend, at most.
Yeah, I mean, he turned one into an
asshole.
We don't
know where Mrs. Uncle Ben is.
No, we don't. She never comes up. She's probably a mummy. But it is kind of cool that they get to go inside this pyramid. It was built in 2500 BC for Pharaoh Khufu. Full of all these elaborate tunnels, and they explain how, all these tunnels were built to confuse would-be tomb robbers and all this cool stuff. Freaking Gabe is so jazzed. And Sari, says, Gabe, you'll probably be too scared to go. I've already been. You'll probably be too scared to go. You'll probably be too scared. And he's like, no. And so they go and he toughens up. He's like, no, I won't be scared. And they get there and they go down a rope ladder. That's how you get into a pyramid. Pyramids, according to this book, they don't look on the inside like I expect. A lot of rope ladders inside pyramid. I didn't know that was a thing. A lot of rope ladders. They go down a rope ladder. Gabe, squip, oh, he cuts his little hand on the rope, loses his grip, and falls. Dum, dum, dum! Chapter 4.
No. That's not how the book describes it. They say he cuts his hand and he takes both of his hands away from the rope, not expecting it, and then he falls. Like, it's not he slips. He's like, ow! Oh, the rope ladder bit me. I will let go of it now.
Yeah, never let go of the rope ladder that bit you.
I do like that Gabe is actually interested in ancient Egypt and mummies and stuff. Like, if he had been like, I don't want to be here. This is boring. I would have left the podcast if I had to endure because that's the nice thing about both of them. At least they're not being like, oh, this sucks. This is boring. Look at all this sand. They're both excited to be in the tombs and stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway, I've let Gabe fall for long enough. Sari apparently is actually a superhero and grabs both of his wrists and stops him cold, like from falling. Like,
yeah. Was she above him?
Yeah, she was on. So is Uncle Ben went down first, so he could shine the light on the ladder for them, and then so. But Gabe, I keep wanting to replace everyone's names with the previous Goosebump name. So I keep wanting to call Gabe Evan, and then because Gabe was at first just like, I'm going to go down the ladder first, and Uncle Ben was like, all right, calm down, You don't need to show off for your cousin for several different reasons that we'll talk about later. I'll go down the ladder first, then you come. So then that's why Gabe was next, and then he fell, and then Sari grabs him and then lifts him up, I guess, she does a lot of core strength workouts.
Sure.
And she says, like, you're welcome.
Yeah. And this embarrasses him again. He had to be saved by the cousin that teases him so. But they get down in there. They go inside these ancient, stagnant what's the word I'm looking for? Is acrid the word I want? Does that describe acrid. Air? Yeah.
Acrid will work in this game.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a bitter, biting smell more. I think this is more of like if you were smelling like ammonia. Might be more acrid, I would say.
Well, they're in there without masks, which...
That's gross.
Yeah, I don't know why. I don't think you can go down there without masks these days. I feel like you got to wear some respiratory device. That's just me being an overbearing parent and role follower myself. But no mentions of masks here, so I won't get bent out of shape about it. But I will say, a lot of dust down there, a lot of mold. You should be wearing one. Okay, we go on.
It's a desert. They're fine.
Yeah. They meet workers. These are folks that are, I guess, that work along with Uncle Ben, and they're down there digging, as you do inside a pyramid, apparently. And the kids are introduced to Ahmed. And he's described as an Egyptian academic who warns of curses. This is the guy that Uncle Ben was talking about. He's like, got this crazy guy at work. He's always talking about curses, and we'll be cursed if we keep going down this pyramid. So that must be Ahmed that they're introduced to. And around this time, Uncle Ben gets distracted by his coworkers. They're over there digging. They're having a conversation about which way to sort of the directions to dig, what they need to be doing. And Sari uses this opportunity while Dad's distracted to get Gabe to go along with her mischief.
Like, she's deliberately doing stuff that A, could get them killed. And B is definitely going to get them in trouble with Uncle Ben, because she immediately is just like, let's get out of here. It's boring. He's going to be there for hours. It's like, it's been 5 minutes. And to Gabe's credit, he's just like, I don't think we should go. And she's like, don't worry about it, you chicken. Because all of a sudden, Gabe is Marty McFly, and all she has to do is like, bah-caw. And then he's, all right.
Yeah.
Let's get lost in these tunnels.
And it becomes a thing in this book how easily everyone can just become distracted and get separated. I had never seen three people lose sight of each other so easily as these folks do. Now, I understand that pyramids are twisty and turdy and dark and weird, but I think if you pulled any three people off the planet and stuck them in the situation, I think they could keep track of each other for longer than these three. So when they separate from Uncle Ben, Gabe following Sari, she's like, I was in here. I've been in here before. I know where I'm going. Let's go look at some I know where some cool stuff is to look at. We could just go peek around the corner and go look at it. Trust me. Just follow me. We'll go. He's like, all right, I'll go. She gets really far ahead of him. Now, Gabe, and I don't know if this was the thing for me too, Dylan. I don't know if it was just the way shoes were made in this time, but there's always one shoe that I had that would get untied, you know? Something about it. One shoe was just always a little bit more loose on the knots. And the same thing happens to Gabe here. His little shoe comes untied. He has to bend down to tie his shoe. The world's going on around him. He doesn't see it. Looks up. She gone.
And this is a dun-dun-dun moment, except it's more just like, sorry. So, can't find her. She's not answering him. He's lost. And he's thinking about, like, as he's trying to find her, and I think he tells himself, like, it's all just one big tunnel, and we find out later that's not true. So no. That's also horrifying.
Yeah.
Because Uncle Ben is like, there are thousands of tunnels. So he remembers a time, I think when they were like eight, like they were much younger, and he decided, I'm gonna take her down to the haunted house, and that'll really fix her wagon. And so he's like, takes her down to the house. He's like, oh, there's ghosts and things in there. And she'll be really scared. And she definitely wants to go. And they're both excited. Once they get into the house, though, she's just like, we should split up. And he's like, good idea, wink. Because he's going to scare her. This is going to go extremely well for Gabe. Except then it starts thundering outside. And a storm picks up. And it's starting to get a little spooky even for Gabe. And he's like, all right, I got to find Sari. So he looks for her, and he looks for her, and he's yelling and calling, and she doesn't answer. And just doesn't answer and doesn't answer. And he panics and he's just like, I've got to get help. And he runs out of there and he's running through the rain, probably tears streaming, but you can't tell because there's so much rain. And he gets home and he's drenched to the bone. He's like, Mom, I got sorry, killed by ghosts. And then she's actually sitting at the table, perfectly dry, eating a slice of chocolate cake, which I feel like cake wasn't even an option until Sari came back home dry and safe. And she's like, you know what? There will also be cake for Sari. And I love that Evan has a very clear memory of Sari deliberately not responding to him and hiding from him after she splits off from him. And yet he does not use that to inform his thoughts as he progresses into this tunnel. I'm saying Gabe might be dumb. he's searching the pyramid. He's like, you know what? I remember that time that she was a jerk, but I'm just going to explore. And then he finds a sarcophagus.
Mm.
A stone coffin. It's got a face on it that looks like a death mask, like what he's seen in children's, like in school books. It's like, I don't remember seeing death masks, like proper death masks, school books. So I believe it's also like a smaller coffin, as it's described at one point. But he gets closer and closer, and the lid starts to creak open.
Oh.
Slowly.
Ooh.
Slowly. He sees two glittering eyes staring.
Dum dum dum. Yeah, of course. That was Sari. We all knew it. We all saw that coming, right? Mm-hmm. We all saw that one coming.
He should have known it.
Yeah, he should have known. He just told us a story setting that up, that it would be her there to crush his soul. Which I guess better her than a mummy at that point. But of course, she ridicules him for being scared. You big dummy. How weak are you, you weaky? She doesn't say any of those words, but you can put it all together. Uncle Ben now shows up. He's finally caught up. He's been looking for them kids. And he's angry. They could have gotten lost. He leads them out. We're getting out of here. We're going to go to Chick-fil-A. I've had enough of you kids in here today. They go back to the hotel. And here we get a little slice of life from 1992 childhood. Or I guess 1993.
So it's Christmas of 1992. So technically the book took place in 1992.
Oh, there you go. Well, we get a little slice of life here. I like this pair of paragraphs. It makes me a little bit nostalgic, back when there was nothing else better to do. He says, we spent the night back in the hotel in Cairo. I beat Sari in two straight games of Scrabble, but it didn't make me feel any better. She kept complaining that she only had vowels, and so the games weren't fair. Finally, I put my Scrabble set back in my room, and we sat, stared at the TV. I don't know. That just made me feel... That just made me feel very 1992, where you would just play Scrabble, and then when that was done, you'd put that away, and then you would just stare at the TV, not watch the TV. I like that it was specifically stare at the TV, because I feel like I did that a lot back then, because you didn't have a lot of agency over what you could watch. There were just things on, and you could look at them.
Yeah.
You couldn't just watch something.
Even in hotels, when you most likely had more channels in hotel TV than you did at home, even now... When we go on like road trips or wherever, or we're staying in a hotel, my wife and I specifically look for hotel TV shows that are just like those shows that you just kind of put on at the end of your day of wherever you're vacationing, and it does not take any brain power. You just let it wash over you.
Yeah.
Like Forge and Fire or that Cat Hell show.
Oh, that's a good
show. That guy who...
Yeah. He's got the facial
hair. Just shows that...
Yeah,
you feel good by the end of them usually. And
I'll tell you what's not fine or enjoyable. Two of Uncle Ben's co-workers got sick last night. They've been taken to the hospital. What's going on? Seems like they got sick on the job. Huh, maybe they should have been wearing masks. That's what I would say. Probably got some kind of weird respiratory syndrome from being down there, not taking care of your breathing. But anyway, Uncle Ben, he's got to go check it out. He's responsible for these folks. So he's like, hey, kids, listen, stay at the hotel. I know you will. I trust you. You'll stay right here. You won't leave. Every time I tell you to stay somewhere, I come back, you're right here. It's pretty amazing how it works. So I'm going to go on. Stay here at the hotel. Don't leave. Stay here inside this hotel room. And Sari, as soon as Uncle Ben leaves, immediately wants to leave. Immediately. Like, I don't even think R.L. Stine says, Uncle Ben, shut the door. I think he just made a move toward the door, and then Sari looks at Gabe and was like, we're getting out of here.
To be honest, I believe that, because Uncle Ben probably would have been like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, he doesn't care. Yeah. He's like, I'm mostly uncle. I'm some dad, mostly uncle. So Gabe is so easily talked into this time because right now he feels like the score is not in his favor. I mean, so what? He won a couple games of Scrabble. And that didn't fix anything. He's been embarrassed way too much, both on this trip and his whole life, by Sari. He does not want to come off as weak, so he's like, yeah, sure. Yeah. I don't want to look like a wimp again. Yeah, where do you want to go?
She even starts to give him an out, like, as they get to the lobby and they look outside and they step out. Sari's just like, you know, if you're too scared to go, we could hang back. But because she's been such a little shit this whole book and her whole life, he's like, nah, I guess if you're scared, we gotta go to the museum now. So, sorry, you suck. Like, you've made this happen and worse because you're an awful person. But it's only two blocks. It's not that bad. I used to walk further in New York when I was a child.
Yeah.
The streets of the Bronx. They're fine in Cairo.
Yeah, Cairo. The easy streets of Cairo. That's what it's known for.
That's how I've often heard them described.
Yes. Please send all your angry emails about that and how we're wrong to wegotgoosebumpspodcast@gmail.com. So, yeah, so they leave this note. Yeah. They head to the nearby museum. They left the room. Dum, dum, dum. Chapter 7.
And that's how you know that Gabe is smart. Whenever you leave, make sure that there's someone who knows where you're going.
That's right. That's true. Huh. That sounded like...
Especially when you go on a hike.
That was in your sarcasm cadence, but that is actually really good advice.
No, I'm saying, like, this is actually good on Gabe. And there was a moment there where I was just going to, she was giving, oh, are you too scared to go? Because you're writing a note? And he's just like, eh. But he still writes the note, which I'm glad, because, like, if you let her talk you out of leaving a note, which is literally the best thing you could do, I'm going to be furious, and I'm going to throw both of these children off a hotel balcony. It was so frustrating.
Yeah, that happens.
But anyway, so they walk down to the museum, and it's the way R.L. Stine describes it. I feel like maybe just pictures were seen, because it seems very kind of like there's big staircases and columns, and they walk up a lot of stairs, and they keep walking up a lot of stairs, and they're really tired up these stairs. So then they have a race, and they get to the top of the stairs, and then we're good, and they get to the Egyptian exhibit, and. The best part is this is Gabe's moment to shine, and this was my moment to shine as a child,
yes.
Which is, what is the grossest thing you know about anything, and who do you want to tell it to right now?
Honestly, this is where the book actually, like, finally gets interesting. I feel like till now, I've not dug this book. It's been a lot of kid teasing and generally just teasing us with mummy stuff, not really getting into any mummy stuff. Here, we get it all. We get a little spooked. I'm going to spoil what's going to happen in the next 2 minutes, but we get like an attempted kidnapping, and we get to hear about brains. I mean, chapter 7, honestly, is where this game gets on the board, or where this book gets on the board, on the scoreboard. I'm talking about it like it's a sport. It's where it gets on the board, it gets on the friggin' scoreboard.
Yeah.
Anyway, now, I know you would take delight in this, Dylan, and you have a copy of the book. I don't know if you would like to read it, but I have it marked here. I was going to read precisely where Gabe takes delight in explaining to Sari how... I'm sorry, I say Sari sometimes. I say sorry sometimes. I'm unpredictable. But how the brains are removed from the mummies.
Would you want to be Sari?
Yeah, I'll be Sari.
Or do you want to be... Do you want to be Sari?
Sorry. I'll be sorry. Sorry, I'll be sorry.
You're going to be sorry.
Oh, goddamn.
Do you know how they made mummies? I asked, moving around to view it from the other side. Do you know the first thing they did? They removed the brain.
Yuck, stop, she said, sticking out her tongue and making a disgusted face.
Don't you know about this? I asked, delighted that I had some truly gruesome information that she didn't.
Please, enough, she said, holding up one hand as if to fend me off.
No, this is interesting, I insisted. The brain has to come out first. And this special tool. It's like a long, skinny hook. They push it up the corpse's nose until it reached the brain and then wiggle it back and forth, until the brain became mush.
Stop! Sari pleaded, covering her ears.
Then they took a long spoon, I continued gleefully, and they scooped the brain out a little at a time. I made a scooping motion with my hand. Scoop, scoop. They scooped the brain out through the nose, or sometimes they popped off an eyeball and scooped the brain out through the eyeball socket.
Gabe, I mean it! Sorry cried. She really looked like she was about to hurl. She was green.
I loved it. I never knew that Sari had a squeamish bone in her body, but I was really making her sick. Outstanding, I thought. I would definitely have to remember this technique. It's all true, I told her, unable to hold back a wide grin.
Just shut up, she muttered.
Of course, sometimes they didn't pull the brain out through the nose. Sometimes they just sliced off the head. And they drained the brains out through the neck and put the head back on the body. They just bandaged it back on, I guess.
Gabe! And here, snap back to the podcast. Sorry, she's looking pretty sick by this description. And she keeps telling him to stop, but it turns out, I mean, it's probably because she also heard the description. She doesn't want to admit that that was bothering her, but she's also actually seeing Ahmed coming toward them from across the other side of the room of the museum. And he's coming fast, and he looks angry, and he's coming after them. He's shouting something. They can't make out what he's saying. And so they run. The kids run. They say, shit, what's... Ahmed, what is he doing? Let's get out of here. Let's run for some reason. Let's just run from him. Let's just go. And so they run all the way. And then finally, he corners them somewhere inside the museum where no one else is around. Dum, dum, dum. Chapter 8.
This part was actually pretty funny to me because the whole time, like, Ahmed's standing there. He's just like, why? Did you yes. run? You know who I am. Your dad asked me to come get you. And it's pretty funny if it had been true, because it's just like, yeah, that is pretty funny. Like, he's probably just like, oh, like, I can see that out of a scene out of like Blank Check or something where you just have like crazy music as the teens run. And then you have like the, you know, Tim Curry from Home Alone 2, like being like, I'm going to get that kid. And it's kind of a zany comedy. None of it's true. He was actually trying to kidnap them the whole time. But we don't know that yet.
We don't know that yet, yeah. And I did. I also thought
it,
that was funny.
It was kind
like,
of funny.
Because they're embarrassed. They're like, I don't... He's like, why did you run? And he kept asking them. They're like, I don't... We don't know. I'm sorry. Why did you run? Why did you run? He's so annoyed. It was funny.
Honestly, I'd be pretty mad to... Like, it's... His reaction is actually completely understandable, which I thought was perfect. It was like... Holy shit. And probably as a bad guy, he's like, why did you run? Like, do I look scared? Like, did you see my knife? Like, what did you see? So it's, I'm sure he was genuinely curious. He's like, do you know I'm the bad guy yet? I think that's not until like chapter 10. Like, come on, guys.
Yeah.
But so he's just like, listen, whatever. I need to take you to your dad. And the kids make a mistake. I think. One of them might say, like, how did you know to be here? And then Sari says, oh, did you see Gabe's note? And he's like, Sari? Because then all he has to do is like, yes, I saw the note in the hotel room.
Yeah.
You got to hold that information back. So if she's like, oh, how did you know where to find us? He's like, oh, your dad called me from the hospital. He's like, how would dad know we were there? Because we were supposed to be in the hotel room.
That's right.
They're 12-year-olds, so I'll cut them some slack. That was the tone I said that. It's like, they're 12-year-olds, so, you know, I'll cut them a break there. When really it's just like, we shouldn't steal 12-year-olds.
Yeah.
By we, I mean Ahmed and criminals.
Yeah, well, Ahmed, he's trying to steal them. He leads them out to his car, even though, as we know, by their plan to get here, it's just a short two-block walk back to the hotel. But Ahmed, he insists on driving them. He doesn't want them out of his sight. Maybe, you know what, he parked illegally. Let's just go. I got to take my car anyway. Won't you guys just hop in? We'll just pop on over. Real quick, I'll park somewhere more legit. We'll be at the hotel, no big deal. You know, he could have come up with any number of excuses, but the kids, they follow him, they get into the car. And once they get into the car, oh man, you know, putting that thing in drive. I'm assuming he's driving like, I'm going to say a Mazda. I don't know what they have over there in Egypt. I'm imagining a Mazda. They get into this Mazda.
I think they said it's like dented on one side, like it's not in good condition. I definitely feel it's like an Acura maybe. Or,
think an Acura.
You know, it's something... You know, Saturn was still around back then. I feel like it was
a Saturn.
You know,
like, I'll settle on a Saturn, like a dark, one of those dark green Saturns.
I feel like it's a good, it used to be a good, like, mid-range car, but now it's been through the beater a couple times.
Absolutely. Well, they get into this deranged Saturn beater, and Gabe, like me, good sense of direction, suddenly realizes, hey, we're not going toward the hotel. We seem to be going away from the hotel. This isn't right.
I would have gotten to the pyramid before I would have realized we had gone in the wrong direction. Like, I don't remember the Great Pyramid of Giza being outside of our hotel, but you know best, mister.
Yeah, it's like
that's how bad my sense of direction. It would have taken me a good 30 minutes to even realize something was wrong, even though it's a 5-minute drive. I've been like, oh, he must have to take the long way for any reason. It's lucky I was never kidnapped as a child, because I would have disappeared.
Because you're so big, you're hard to hide. But anyway, Ahmed, clearly being very creepy at this point, you know, they're telling him, they're trying to plead with him, like, hey, you're going the wrong way, and he's just kind of not paying attention to them. And Gabe and Sari rightfully start to worry that they are, in fact, being kidnapped by Ahmed. Dun, dun, dun! Chapter 9.
But legitimately, they're being kidnapped by Ahmed. Gabe comes up with a good plan. He's like, he's paid attention to traffic patterns. He's aware that they stop fairly frequently. So he's like, unbuckle your seatbelt. And then when I say go, we're going to fucking get out of here, Sari. And Sari's just like, understood. Not really. She's like scared and stuff.
It's a pretty brave plan by Gabe, though, right? Like, it seems a bit.
Yeah, it's a good plan. He actually has a couple of good plans coming up. Like, I actually, like, this is Gabe's moment to shine, and Sari just kind of pees all over it the entire time. Like,
yeah.
He took care of them. Like, he saved them from Ahmed. Let's get to that. Like, they knock open the door, book it out. Just run out of there. And obviously Ahmed can't just ditch his car in the middle of traffic, so he probably doesn't even chase after them, but they lose him. They go through like markets and down side streets and through alleys, and now they're lost in Cairo.
Well, Sari looks afraid, which I think Gabe deep down kinda likes. He's like, yeah, now I have the upper hand here. You know, I'm in control. Now she can follow my lead and give me some respect, R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Starts singing Aretha Franklin in the streets. But then he's like, you know what? We need a plan. I need to stop being full of myself here, right out of the woods just yet. He spots a taxi across the street. Hey, let's go get in this taxi. Come on, let's go. They'll take us back to the hotel.
Wicked smart. Pretty lucky. A taxi driver, probably the most likely person in this section who's going to speak or any amount of English. Like, a taxi driver probably hears a lot of different languages and can, like, kind of figure out, like, oh, yeah, I know where you need to go.
Exactly.
Knows the area. So smart. Good job, Gabe.
Great job. So they climb in. They say they want to go to the hotel, you know, Hotel Cairo, whatever the name of the hotel is. They say that.
The Cairo Center Hotel.
Cairo Center Hotel. Thank you, Dylan. And then the driver, unexpectedly, begins to laugh maniacally. Now, is he in on it? Is he also a kidnapper? Is he working for Ahmed? Did they say something funny? Ah, he's laughing like a madman, Dylan. Damn, damn, damn. Chapter 10.
And Sari's convinced. Like, she is saying, like, oh no, he works for Ahmed. And like, in my head, I was like, I swear to God, R.L. Stein, if you have this guy working for Ahmed, this is another tree moment for you, because the odds that they would randomly happen across this. But so she's like, we need to book it. And Gabe, like, is about to pop open the door, and the taxi driver's like, whoa, 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 whoa. And then he just points to his windshield and is like, Cairo Center Hotel. And they're literally right across the street from it. They somehow, through their crazy runabouts, have gone all the way back to their hotel. And that's why he thinks that's funny. And that is pretty funny, too. Like, if two people came up to me desperately saying, like, I need to get to this place, help me, I'd be like, bro, you're welcome. That'll be $5.50.
Yeah.
Because there is a flat rate. I'm sorry. We have to make some money. So there is a flat rate. That's $5.
It makes you wonder how far they ran. I guess they took some shortcuts through some back alleys, ended up covering a ton of ground there through.
So he probably only made it 3 blocks.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, with traffic and everything. Traffic in there, yeah. He didn't get very far.
They didn't get very far.
They spent 20 minutes going 5 blocks.
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, they're at the hotel. So they don't have to take the taxi cab. They can get out and go in there and walk. It also makes me second guess how good Gabe is with his directions. I think I'm at least a little bit better than Gabe. So I consider myself directional champion yet again. Sorry, Gabe, you come in second. They get back to the hotel. They go inside the room. Uncle Ben, Are you here? I seem like Ahmed said that he talked to you and you were here and you saw the note. Wait, the note is here. It's untouched. Uncle Ben hasn't been here. That means Ahmed lied. Of course. The guy that tried to kidnap us lied. Ah, dang.
Well, you know, they don't know. Maybe he was taking the shortcut back to the hotel. You don't know. Like, it's easy. Because they already did that to him once, you know, like, they got embarrassed by ditching him. So, like, maybe they did it again. I don't know.
Uncle Ben does show up, though. He comes in very shortly. And he says, hey, guys. You know, he's looking a little rough for wear. It says, those two sick coworkers went to check on. They're in total shock.
All right. I want to call a pause here because the way this was being introduced is like, are they dead? I think they're dead. Is he? Because he's like, they're not so well. And it's just, oh, those two workers are dead. And like, it's not that Arnold Stein won't kill people. Like, he kills bad guys. He's killed at least two bad guys. And in the Dutch version of Monster Blood, he killed those two twins. So it's possible these two workers are dead. And then finally he's like, they're in shock. He's like, oh, what? That's fine. Shock is something you come out of naturally. Like, that's not even a disease. Shock is actually great news because that's just, you know, some therapy, some like, good, like, you know, a couple of like, it's just some medication. They'll be fine. It's not like they have typhoid.
Right. Which would be, you know, pyramid typhoid, I hear, is tough. You don't want that. That's,
it is. Yeah, I've had it three times, but it's... It gets worse every time.
Yeah, no, it's rough. Mm-hmm. Well, Sari then breaks the news to Uncle Ben. He says, she's like, look, sorry about your two coworkers, but your other coworker, Ahmed, tried to kidnap us and potentially murder us. I almost slipped and said murder, but you know what? He was probably going to do that. And then we get a little bit of a backstory on Ahmed. He's a cryptographer. He's an academic, super smart guy. Does believe in curses, but despite that, Uncle Ben, he's a bit surprised by the allegations of Ahmed, and he doesn't even seem that upset that his daughter was nearly kidnapped. He just seems disappointed with the allegations. He's not like, "Oh my God, sir, I'm so glad that you ran and that you're safe." Oh, but he's like, "Really, Ahmed was the one that tried to kidnap you? Of all my friends,
yeah.
I wouldn't have pegged Ahmed as the kidnapper. That's something."
So there's a couple of things here where, like, he said, like, he came with excellent credentials from the Cairo Museum, and it's like, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, I always pictured, like, anytime someone talked about credentials or having great credentials, I pictured that being like a thing, like a badge or something, like, just like you would unfold it and be like, these are my credentials, and it'd be like a gold like unrolled book. But anyway, also when Sari tells him about the story, she puts the blame on Gabe because she's like, Gabe wanted to see mummies, so we went to the Cairo Museum. It's like, that's how she started the explanation. She's so awful.
She's the worst.
And she does it again later. Like,
she's the worst.
And Gabe doesn't even notice it. He's just like, I picked up the story at that point. He's like, you need to go back and undig yourself out of that hole she just put you in, buddy.
I know, man. I know. She is the worst. And I think when I took the notes for these chapters, it was too painful and annoying for me to even write some of the shit she said. You have to go back and read it, folks, to get the real... To feel all the prickly thorns that she sticks in Gabe every time she speaks. She is the worst human being ever written in a Goosebumps novel. So far, if we have to chart it, she's the worst person.
She's worse than that cat lady who made Evan's aunt deaf for 20 years. Like, she's worse than that person.
Oh, by a long shot. Yeah, 100%.
But, at one point where, like, the pranks turned from, like, oh, that was kind of funny to, like... extremely cruel was like, or when she was hiding in the mummy case and Uncle Ben comes up to them and he's like furious at them with the first time they get lost in the pyramid. As they're walking away, she tells him how she scared Gabe. Like, I was playing practical joke and scared him. And Uncle Ben's like, and they both look back at Gabe and point and laugh at him. It's just like, you're encouraging her to do this again. Like, you just spent 3 seconds yelling at her for doing this, and then you're just like, yeah, stick it to that kid. You know what? Next time, make sure he doesn't get out of here alive. Like, that's what they're whispering to each other.
Yeah.
It must be, like, a good son situation, except it's the good daughter.
Yeah. No. I mean, there's a reason that she behaves the way she does. She's been rewarded for this behavior before by Uncle Ben, who Gabe loves, but Gabe, listen, your Uncle Ben... bad father. Great uncle, though. That is perfect uncle behavior.
See,
you want that in
exactly.
Uncle.
Gabe loves him, as an uncle, but as a dad, this is the problem I have to deal with. I'm holding up, sorry, you can't see it because I'm not actually holding anyone up, but the
yeah,
this is again what, when I think about like reading these books as an adult and being like, what is the home life situation for Uncle Ben and sorry, because I don't think it's a good one.
There's a reason, as you mentioned, and now it could be pyramid typhoid, but there's a reason there's no Mrs. Uncle Ben. And my thought is that they tried to prank her and suffocated her in some kind of coffin. And then she died.
Well,
and then they laughed.
A perfect opportunity.
They thought that was hilarious.
I will see later.
I know.
Oh, yeah.
They thought it was great. They were like, wow, we killed Mom. Ha 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 ha.
Did you see The Good Son?
No.
It's we might need to watch it this Halloween just because it's kind of a fun, it's a very 90s movie because it's got Macaulay Culkin and little baby Elijah Wood in it.
Let's watch it. Well, anyway, sorry, somehow, given everything that's going on, talks Uncle Ben to taking them to the pyramid with him because he has to go. Uncle Ben wants to find out what caused this to his two coworkers. He can't believe what has happened. They were sick. They're in shock. What happened to them? He has to go and check it out. I don't know how she's able to talk Uncle Ben into this because a couple things are at play here. One, the person that tried to kidnap her works there. Two, something happened there that nearly killed, seemingly, two of his coworkers. And three, the last time they went there, they didn't listen to him and they went and they got lost. But it seems like an easy thing to talk Uncle Ben into. He's like, well, you know, I got to figure out what happened to these coworkers. I can't just leave you guys in the hotel room. Clearly, you don't listen to those instructions. What am I going to do? So, to kind of help himself, he gives these kids a very 90s piece of technology. Well, I guess it's 90s. It seems like, you know, actually, even for 90s, it seems kind of forward-thinking. Some tracking pagers for the off chance, they all become separated so that they'd be able to press a button, you know, signal a beep to someone who might be lost to come find them, and it beeps as they get close. It's kind of a ranged communicator that lets you track people that when you get separated. So at least they have some technology on their side, Dylan. You know, it's not the greatest situation. If it were me, I would say, you stay in this hotel room. I would have paid the concierge at that hotel. I'd be like, you make sure they do not leave, and if they leave that room, you call my cell phone that probably doesn't get signaled down in the fucking pyramid, or you know what, shoot the kids on site if they leave the hotel room, but let somebody know rather than take them anywhere near this pyramid that's full of chaos, murder, and kidnappers,
and also an important historical site. Like there's a bottom level of like, these children shouldn't be here, and then there's like 60 other reasons, like a murderous kidnapping, cryptographer, like just maybe. And their whole reason is like, oh, because he might come back. It's like, all right, I guess that's true. Lock the door. Go down to the hotel manager. Say there's a creep who's like trying to steal your kids. Switch rooms so he doesn't know where you are now. Like, it's... And tell the hotel security so they can stop him. Nope. He's going to take them into the middle of a pyramid.
Yeah.
And then do a terrible job.
Yes. So we went. I just went through all this trouble talking about how we had these tracking pagers. We had to make sure they had batteries, make sure they worked. We've got them. Clip them onto your belt. Don't become separated. All right. Great. We got that. The three of us are going to stick together. And once we get to the pyramid, Gabe immediately becomes separated. Like within seconds. They just walk through the front door and then Gabe disappears more or less. Is what it seems like. Less than a page.
This honestly is like if the three of them walked into a house and he somehow got lost on the porch. Like, it's insane. Like, and I don't blame Gabe because Uncle Ben is the adult here. At what point did he turn around and was like, gosh, I had two of these. Where did the other one go?
I know. Like, I'm like, how hard can it be?
He should have... Like, he should have tied a rope to each of them. Like,
a rope.
It
yes.
is mind-boggling to me. And, like, this made me so angry already. But, yes, they're lost. And so, like, dun-dun-dun.
Well, they're lost. We gotta touch on it a little bit. They're lost specifically because Uncle Ben and Sari are bickering a little bit while walking together. And Gabe has to stop to tie that one goddamn shoe that keeps coming untied. We were all familiar with that one shoe that kept being untied. I don't have that issue as an adult. My shoes stay tied all the time. But up until I was 15, this felt like at any given moment one was untied. I don't know what's up with that. Maybe I just didn't tie them hard enough. I don't know. But it happened again.
I think that's that. We were also 8. Why did I think we were 13? I can't do math. 1993. I'm sorry. I'm referencing something I said 2 hours ago.
Oh, okay. Well, at any rate, Gabe has now become separated. Dum, dum, dum. Chapter 11. So, all right. So, chapter 11 here. Gabe, he starts to second guess every single choice he could possibly make. And, you know, he just looks up and realizes that there's like a fork in the path. So they could have gone left or they could have gone right. And so he says, they must be around the next curve in the tunnel, I told myself. It hadn't taken me that long to tie my shoelace. They couldn't have gone that far ahead. Hearing a sound, I stopped and listened. Silence now. Was I starting to hear things? I had a sudden flash. Was this another mean practical joke? Were Sari and Uncle Ben hiding, waiting to see what I'd do? Was this another lame trick of theirs to frighten me? It could be. Uncle Ben, I knew, could never resist a practical joke. He had laughed like a hyena when Sari told him how she had hidden the mummy case and scared about 10 years off my life. Were they both hiding in mummy cases now, just waiting for me to stumble by? My heart thumped in my chest. Despite the heat of the ancient tunnel, I felt cold all over. No, I decided, this isn't a practical joke. Uncle Ben was too serious today, too worried about his stricken workers, too worried about what we had told him about Ahmed. He wasn't in any mood for practical jokes. I began making my way through the tunnel again. As I jogged, my hand brushed against the beeper at my waist. Should I push it? Nah, that would only give Sari a good laugh. She'd be eager to tell everyone how I'd started beeping for help after being in the pyramid for 2 minutes. I turned the corner. The tunnel walls seemed to close in on me as the tunnel narrowed. Sari? Uncle Ben? No echo. You know, maybe the tunnel was too narrow for an echo. I stopped when the tunnel branched into two directions. I suddenly realized how scared I was. Where had they disappeared to? There's two tunnels. Which one had they entered? Poor guy. At this rate, he's never even going to take a step forward, Dylan, much less find anyone. But I can relate to that sense of second-guessing everything when you're a little bit scared, when you're a little bit lost. Even if it's work-related, we're adults, so we have a work task, and you're like, should I do it this way? Should I do it that way? Should I ask so-and-so for help? But what if, you know, I shouldn't be asking that person for help because then they'll think I'm a goober. I should already know how to do that. Shouldn't ask them for help. Maybe I'll just Google it instead. Well, you know, I don't know about Google. You know, not all jobs are equal. If I Google, I get somebody else. You know, it's not the same. It's not the same thing. I need to figure out how to do it on my own. It's like constant second guessing. I can relate to Gabe so much in this, even though I'm clowning him a little bit. We've all been there, Dylan.
Yeah. That's definitely the worst part of like when you start to get that little bit of that panic going, and because having a plan, that's the best feeling. Even if things are going horribly wrong around you, knowing that you have a plan helps a lot. And when you start second guessing yourself, you start doing really dumb stuff, like not pressing the beeper button. And again, Sari is to blame.
Yes, she put in his head that that's a weak move. What a sissy. They would just be around the corner and they would come out and be like, ha ha, you got lost on the porch and had to press the button. Well, at that moment, Gabe falls through the floor. Dum, dum, dum!
So when they're talking about all this crackling noises and stuff, I thought he was like walking on bugs. And I was like, oh, he's going to look down and he's going to see bugs. And then he looked down and then he fell through the floor. And it's like, oh, that caught me off guard.
Yeah.
But he does manage to like, lands, not well. A couple things break his fall, his own body, and a couple more important items. But the important thing is his flashlight shines like it's lying on the floor. Beam goes across from him, and it doesn't land on Compton's grave this time. That flashlight beam lands shines on a human hand.
Ooh.
And I think it first says it's a hand. A human hand. It's like,
Yep, had that going the whole time.
Can we whack up to who else's hand? I guess it could be a monkey's paw.
And that's still a paw, though, but right? Wouldn't you still call that a paw? Because I was thinking the same thing. I was like,
that's true.
Could it be...
But they have thumbs. I would call it a hand, too.
Would it be... Is it a monkey paw? Do you call it... You know, is there a difference between a monkey's hand?
I mean, the story is the monkey's paw.
Right.
But that story also believes that monkeys can grant you wishes if you wish on their paws.
Sure. But is there a difference between like a monkey's paw and like would you say a gorilla's paw or would you say a gorilla's hand? I feel like gorillas have hands and monkeys have paws. I feel like there's like a separation.
Monkeys have. I feel like if you can shake it like a human hand, like if I held out my hand,
like if you're doing business,
a monkey could shake my hand. I'll call it a hand because then I don't have to say like, I'll shake your paw. That's like, that's, you know, if you're shaking a paw, you know, you're shaking a paw. If you're shaking a hand, you know, you're shaking a hand. There you go. Boom, the hand test.
Okay. Well, anyway, it shines on a hand that we assume is not gorilla or monkey, but human hand.
Well, a mummy hand. I think he even says, cause I think he sees that it's wrapped and he says it smells bad. I always appreciate when books talk about
me
smell,
too.
Sometimes they don't.
Yes. And I will say,
R.L.
Stein...
Movies are bad about smell.
No, movies are bad about smell. I agree with that.
There's so many times where a character will be like, I'm completely fine in this house, and they turn on the light, and the walls are covered in blood, and it's like...
You just smell copper.
I don't know if you know this, but blood smells bad and strong, and they're just like... Oh, I'm surprised. It's like, you would have smelled that three doors down before you got to that house.
I'm with you there, bud. Well, R.L. Stein does a really good job of describing smell in the later half of this book, and it's some of my favorite pieces that we're going to get to. And even in this room, he describes it as having the smell of death and decay, which makes sense, because he sees like a dead decaying hand there. So, I mean, it tracks. Yeah. And then, you know, he's kind of gathering himself. He's looking around the room he's just fallen into. He realizes there's a mummy standing upright against a far wall. Oh, my God, a mummy. Dab, dab, dab. Dylan, this is your chapter. This is number 13.
Oh, you know what? I think I'll kick it off with he's looking at this mummy, and he starts realizing it's not just one mummy. There are lots of mummies in this room, and it is a sight to behold. And if I may, Travis, since this is chapter 13, I think I'd like to read that description of...
Please!
The light burned through the shadows, revealing bandaged arms, torsos, legs, covered faces. There were so many of them. There were mummies lying against the wall. Mummies lying on stone slabs, arms crossed over their chests. Mummies leaning at odd angles, crouched low or standing tall, their arms straight out in front of them like Frankenstein monsters. Against one wall stood a row of mummy cases, their lids propped open. I turned, following the arc of my light. I realized that my fall had dropped me into the center of the room.
Wow. Surrounded by all them mummies. You know, I kind of take comfort in... I feel like if I were in there and I saw mummies, I'd be like, well, at least they're dead. I'm more afraid of, like, living things, right? Like, animated mm-hmm. creatures, things like that.
If you think about, like, what we think of undead monsters, like, they pretty thoroughly disabled these mummies before they could come back. Like, they took out their brain. All their organs are gone.
Yeah.
They're literally just...
Skin,
you know,
husk.
Skin and bone. Yeah. Like, and cotton wadding. Like, I think they stuff... They do stuff into the, like, the body cavity so it doesn't sink too much. So they're basically just stuffed animals wrapped in human skin and bones.
That's right. And he's surrounded by a ton of them, arranged in odd ways. I mean, it is, you know, when you're in a pyramid, you expect these things to be in sarcophagi. And these are just kind of laying around. Like, this is a warehouse full of mummies. And he looks around and he finds tools and pots and... jars with strange liquids and odd looking, maybe it's organs inside of them. There's a pool of an odd, dark, tar-like substance. And Gabe kind of realizes, he thinks he's landed where the mummies are made. Landed in the mummy shop. You know, it reminds me of a funny anecdote. Dylan, I need to share here. And you probably had mummy talk you wanted to bring up. But this reminds me of a very funny thing that my dad told me about my grandfather, who I never met because he died before I was born. But my grandfather had this beef against this family called the Blevinses. Now, what's funny about this is my best friend was a Blevins. So this is why my dad loved telling the story. And I think it was kind of made up. But the Blevins family was just all over the place. If you look through a phone book where I'm from, the B's go for pages. It's just Blevinses all the way down. Just millions of them. And apparently my grandpa got sick of them. He hated Blevins. There's too many of them. They're everywhere. He worked for one, and they worked for him, and he just didn't like any of them. And so he said he got drunk one night, he got mad, and he got in his car, and he drove all through the night. And he drove, and he drove, and he drove, trying to get away from those Blevinses, and he got a hotel. And for my grandpa, like, you know, back in the day, distances were longer. The interstate system didn't invent yet. So when he said he drove all through the night, somehow we live in Virginia, somehow he only ended up in Rockingham, South Carolina, which is not that far. You drive through the night, you get to Florida. But he only made it like a couple states over. So he didn't make it very far.
I don't know. I remember driving down those mountain roads in Virginia. Nowadays, I can't imagine driving too very far or very fast on those mountain roads
right.
in your grandfather's days.
Exactly.
So I have a feeling 8 hours were just getting down the mountain.
Maybe.
And then the rest of that time was getting to South Carolina.
He got there. And he got a hotel room, and he went inside, paid for the hotel room with all of the money that he had, went to bed, woke up the next morning, got a cup of coffee, looked out the window, opened up the shades, looked out the window, and was right across from Blevins Manufacturing Company. And he said, "God damn, I came right to where they make them. I came right to where they make them."
That is the perfect Southern granddad. Like, I could picture my grandfather telling me that story.
The thing is, I think it could be true, but that's, you know, it's funny because he's been running from these mummies and he came right to where they fucking make them. He came right to the mummies manufacturing facility.
It is 100% true, and it 100% also didn't happen, but it is still true.
But yeah, so he's down here, he's where the mummies are made, and he decides, okay, well, now would be a great time, now that I've gotten up, I got the wind knocked out of me earlier, I've stood up, I found that I'm in a bad spot, now would be a great time to use the pager to call for Uncle Ben. So what's he do? He pulls out that pager, and Dylan, what's going to happen here? Is the pager going to be working or not? What's the coin flip?
Well, I don't know if you remembered what happened to that flashlight after it landed and shone on Compton Dawes's grave, but that flashlight was pretty well smashed, and unfortunately, so's the pager. Apparently, he landed on the pager, because that's the only way I can think of that working.
Yeah.
It was hooked on his belt.
I think he did fall on his side when he landed. It seemed to make sense. I bought it. When I read
it,
I was like, of course.
He hit his elbow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hitting your elbow when you're a kid, and now, is the worst.
Seriously.
For any joint.
Seriously. Literally, just take the butt of a gun and smash me in the back of the head. Don't go for my elbows. I say that to anybody who robs a bank that I'm inside of. Anyway, so we get a dump, dump, dump after that, because now what is he going to do? He's strapped down there in the mummy-making facility. Chapter 14. Now, here's where we get to a good spot, Dylan. Chapter 14, you and I talked a little bit earlier about how we love it when a book describes smells. And I got to say, R.L. Stine doesn't hold back here. Here at the beginning of chapter 14, he says, everything seems to move in on him. And he says, I realized I was gripping the flashlight so tightly my hand hurt. The light played over the faceless figures. They weren't moving. Of course they weren't moving. I took another step back. The sour odor seemed to grow stronger, thicker. I held my breath, but the smell was in my nostrils, in my mouth. I could taste it, taste the decay, taste the 4,000-year-old aroma of death. I loved that line. I thought that was pretty neat.
That's great.
Getting that taste in your mouth, we've all kind of experienced that, like, ah. So mm-hmm. thick, and it's encompassing, it's suffocating, and I get that. I feel the thick air down there. I feel the stagnant thick air that he's in, and just that sour stitch. So good.
Yeah, it's a great whenever he gets in those little descriptive, and he did a great job. One of the things I loved about in Say Cheese and Die, kind of like the hospital scene where he talks about like the son in that one, all he saw were colors, Greg. All he saw were the colors of the hospital wings that were passing. Yeah. He was too rattled because of his dad's death. Like he does these great little, like sometimes like the either visual or aural, just kind of a descriptions of some sort of sense, and really pulls you in. And I think also because like I feel like kids really dig into stuff like that. Kids understand, mm-hmm. because for kids, like your sense of smell and your sense of taste, like those senses are stronger because they haven't been burned out by cigarettes and cheap Jack and just, and I mean, my favorite escort, it's always like the highlight of his books are the moments where you're just like, ah, we've gotten to the point where he's just like, time to dig in. Like just,
yeah,
really wind it in. And he's good at it in this very visceral way, and also in kind of those emotional beats, like in that more emotional desperation in Say Cheese and Die.
Yeah, yeah. And he does something a little bit with your other senses here in the same chapter, because it's dark down here. Now, he does have his flashlight, but I think he drops it at some point because he gets scared. Something's under his feet. And he steps, he hears crunches, and he hears skitters. And I think he assumes bugs. He's not real sure. And I just so happened to flip to the page, so I might read a bit of it even here. But he says he hears soft, scrambling sounds down on the floor. Something snapped at his ankle. He says, I kicked hard, but I hit only air. Oh, help. He even says that out loud. There's like nobody down there with him. Oh, help. There were creatures down there, a lot of them. But what were they? Again, something slapped my ankle, and I kicked wildly. Frantically, I bent down, grabbing for the flashlight in the darkness, and touched something hard and warm. Oh, no. I jerked my hand up with a startled cry in the darkness. Groping for the flashlight, I had the feeling that the entire floor had come to life. The floor was moving in waves, rolling and tossing, seething beneath me. Finally, I found the flashlight. I grabbed it up in my trembling hand, climbed on my feet, and struggled to turn it back on. Now, he goes on like this for a long time, him like trying to pick up the flashlight, and he can feel these things hitting him. They're hard and prickly. They make clicking sounds. They're snapping. They're bumping into each other. And after more and more lines of this, we find out that he is surrounded by scorpions. Scorpions.
Yeah.
It's like a page and a half of him describing the anxiety-inducing moment of being surrounded by angry scorpions and not being able to see them in the dark. I thought this was a really cool part of the book.
I don't like that. I don't like... So scorpions, I've had, I don't think, any real-world experience with scorpions. So scorpions to me are still like a monster bug to me. Like, I've seen lots of bugs and like spiders and things, but because I've never actually encountered a real scorpion, they're like a nightmare still to me. Like those are the monsters of, and if you look at them, it's just like, what part of them is safe? Like it's, you've got the little dagger tail, the pincers, they probably bite too because they eat other insects. So they'll chop down. So yeah. Not other insects because they're not whatever. So scorpions creep me out.
Yeah. He's surrounded by a ton of them.
I also want scorpions. They're so cool looking too at the same time.
Nah, well, they are kind of cool. I do, as a creature, I do think God made them, like he gave them armor and way too many weapons. Like, it's a good thing he made them small. I'll say that. I mean, you've played Fallout, those rad scorpions. Have you been attacked by a rad scorpion in Fallout? It is exhilarating and terrifying.
I mean, there's lots of stuff that's exhilarating in that game. I do the Skyrim flower shuffle, too, in Fallout, except there's better food options, so I'm less eating bags of flour when I'm fighting a rat scorpion. But, yeah, those are... because they dig.
Yeah.
The last thing you need is one of those coming up on underground.
Oh, getting you right in the tank? That'd be the rough thing. Well, you know what? He's frantic still.
I Fallout 4.
He realizes that he's surrounded by scorpions. He somehow trips, he falls face first right into a nest of these scorpions. But at that moment, somewhat miraculously, two hands grab him before he hits the ground. Uh-oh, Dylan. Is it Uncle Ben? Is it a mummy? Is it Ahmed? Dum, dum, dum! Chapter 15.
This is where I kind of hoped only one child would make it out of the pyramid. It was Sari saved him, but then spends the entirety of the time blaming Gabe for getting separated. And it's like, no, it is not Gabe's fault on any level. Like, Uncle, I don't understand. Like, does everyone just keep walking? As if someone stops, just like, no, we can't stop. We're like sharks. If we stop, we'll drown in this pyramid. Like, we've got to keep walking. Because, like, she's giving Gabe all this crap for getting lost. And then she's immediately like, oh yeah, my dad stopped to talk to someone. And I just wandered away and got lost myself. It's like, ugh.
Yeah.
What is Uncle Ben doing?
She's the worst.
And what is Sari doing?
Yeah, no, it's like, did you also get separated from him? Why are you here?
Yeah, like, you're not allowed to get... It was like, oh, he was very frantic looking for... He's like, you don't think he's very frantic looking for you? He's like, nah, I'm okay.
Yeah.
My own dad wants me dead. But, you know, just, it's so obnoxious. And then Gabe doesn't even get... So Gabe is like, look at this thing I found. Isn't it amazing? These are mummies. I've named them all after me in some fashion. It is my discovery. I'm amazing. And then she's just like, well, if I hadn't saved your life, you never would have found it. And he's like, are you serious right now? Could you give him this? Just let him have this. And she's like, my dad will take your discovery and make a fortune with it.
She's the worst. She is the worst. And so, yeah, apparently she became separated from Uncle Ben. He stopped to talk to a coworker while they were walking. She just kept walking. And if she's been lost and looking for Uncle Ben, she's got a pager. She could use it. She didn't use it. So she's as dumb and as culpable for her own, I don't know, being lost as Gabe is for sure. She's a little bit impressed with the mummy manufacturing facility, that I'll keep calling it that. But again, you're right. Keeps giving Gabe some shit.
I mean, to be fair, she doesn't like this part of the mummy process anyway. Like, this is her least favorite part of Egyptology, is finding out how the sausage is made. So,
yes, thanks to Gabe. So he can take some solace in her discomfort there. He does convince her to use the pager. He's like, hey, your pager work? Because mine doesn't, or else I would have already used it. And she's like, oh, okay, yeah. So she uses a pager to contact Uncle Ben.
No, she didn't say, oh, yeah, yeah. She said, oh, were you too stupid to use yours, and that's why you didn't use yours, and now you have to use mine? And he's like, no, mine broke. Like, she gave him crap about that, too. At every moment, she gives him crap.
She's the worst. She is the worst. I wish there was a Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, too, just so she could die. But, you know what? It cannot happen. Not in this lore. So, within a few minutes after using the pager, though, they hear footsteps approaching, and they think, oh, that was fast. Must be old Uncle B coming in. And they run toward the footsteps. Let's catch up to him. Let's shorten the distance traveled. You start walking your way. We'll start walking mine. You know that country song. They'll meet in the middle. It turns out, though, it's not Uncle Ben. It's Ahmed. Uh-oh. Dump, dump, dump. Chapter 16.
So, now we get the monologue. So just as when Spidey, he never went by Spider, he was always Spidey. Just as Spidey cornered Greg and Cheryl, the other person who was almost the worst person until we met Sari. We now have Ahmed coming out and saying, I tried to tell Uncle Ben about the curse. And he's going on about this curse about the tomb and how the kids have disrupted Princess Kala's preparation chamber. And he's monologuing, so we're getting more. He's the one who scared the workers, and he showed them what it might be like to be boiled alive. And I don't know what he meant by that. Like, do you think he, like, cursed them so they felt as if they were on fire? Or he's like, I'm going to put this rotisserie chicken in my tar pit, and you'll see what it's like. I'm like, how did he?
I don't know. I don't know if he
at this point,
took them in there and showed them the mummy making process, or if he threatened them with their just threaten their lives and put them in shock. I don't know.
Because at this point, there has not been a single supernatural thing that has happened in this book. Everything that's happened...
Yes, I agree.
...so far is rational and is just either Sari and Uncle Ben being douchebags or Ahmed on the murder train.
Yes.
But he's scaring off the workers because he can't scare Uncle Ben. His big goal is to scare Uncle Ben so that he can convince Uncle Ben to stop researching these tombs and just get out of here. Because he keeps saying, like, Uncle Ben is very smart. And it's just like, all right, we get it. You like Uncle Ben. Great guy, I guess. Terrible father. Moving on. And as he tells them he's a descendant of Kala. And as a descendant, he has to carry on the curse. And the curse apparently is just murder?
Yeah.
Is what I think we're getting at. But he's like... I tried. So first my plan was like, I'm going to kidnap you. That's why I stole you. And then I would hold you for ransom, basically, and say, stop researching this pyramid or you won't get your kids back. And that's not a great plan. I'm going to be honest with you. That sounds like a death by cop situation at the end of it. Maybe two dead children. And they're still going to research this pyramid because I don't think Uncle Ben can just say like, all right, we're going to just throw away that grant money. I think.
You're probably right.
I don't think kidnapping children is the best method. But now, because the children have, because he had no beef against them necessarily, but like he says to them, he's just like, but now that you've disturbed this tomb, unfortunately, I have to carry out the curse. The curse, again, being murder.
So apparently,
the descendants of Princess Kala over the last 4,000 years have been guarding this tomb. And the way they've done it is, making mummies, basically.
Pretty much.
You know, carrying on the family business of making mummies.
Mm-hmm.
There's one detail, though, that's a little important, which is that they're mummified alive.
Yeah. Yeah. Which would that would send me into shock if I learned about it. I'm not going to lie. So
yeah.
With this, this kind of explaining why... You know, Gabe seemed to notice a lot of the stuff in the mummy making facility looking a bit fresh. You know, for 4,000 years, mm-hmm. mummy's been around a while, but a lot of these utensils seem freshly used. So Ahmed, willing to continue to carry out this curse, brandishes a dagger, makes a move on him kids, which you don't want to do. Where the hell is Uncle Ben now? Dum dum dum. Chapter 17 is here. And the kids, they're going to try to run from Ahmed, but dang this thing. The only way out of this place, the other side of Ahmed. And he's got a big, I don't say he's got a big knife. It's described as a dagger, but he's described as a big guy, fit guy. He's chased him down once before. He could probably take him. So they don't run.
Yeah.
But then here's where Uncle Ben sort of becomes Batman. A rope ladder descends from the hole where Gabe fell, over here in this room. And down comes Uncle Ben. Ah, like Santa Claus. He's going to come right on down.
How is Uncle Ben able to be on a floor that couldn't support a 12-year-old boy?
Doesn't matter.
Yep. So we get the same kind of like, Uncle Ben is just like, what are you doing? Ahmed is just like, I have to do this curse. I've got to kill your kids. Blah. And like, it just, Uncle Ben is like, no. Listen, we're both rational men. Like, I've been, this is very, like, 60s television. I've been watching a lot of 60s television. So it just feels very, like, we're both rational men. We're both scientists. Don't you see there's no such thing as curses? Ahmed listens to that reasonable argument, which isn't really an argument. It's more just like, you're too smart to believe in curses. And Ahmed is just like, no, I'm not. And hits him with a torch. Is it a torch or is it a flashlight? Is it a proper torch?
It's a proper torch. Hits him right upside the head with a flashlight. Yeah. And the way it kind of plays out, it's interesting. I mean, you nailed it. It was a very 60s discussion. Where he's like, we need to talk about this scientist to scientist. Like, that means anything. Scientists, we don't talk to each other. We just write each other.
Scientists hate each other.
We just write each other papers and make each other read them. We don't talk to each other. So anyway, Ahmed, you know, after hearing that logic, though, he does kind of wait a moment where you're like, oh, maybe he's pondering this. But no, he just straight up like a WWE villain just thwap, you know. Takes him right upside the head with his torch, knocks Uncle Ben out cold. Dum, dum, dum. Chapter 18, now we're back to not having Uncle Ben on our side. He entered the ring. You think, oh, it's like when Sting descends in a WCW match. He's going to take a bat to the bad guy, come and be the hero. Yeah, I'm bringing wrestling into this suddenly. And then he gets wiped out. And now you're like, oh, well, that sucked. That didn't do much for us. But Ahmed, you know, now he's on a roll. He's got all the power. He lights the that tar pitch we talked about with that torch. Now there's a bunch of fire down here. It seems like a very flammable place to be honest with you. I don't know if I'd do that, but big fire. And he puts Uncle Ben's body in a nearby coffin. Which Uncle Ben seems like a heavy guy. Ahmed must be a strong fella if he can just hoist Uncle Ben into a coffin, no issue. And Ahmed then insists the kids each get into a separate coffin together. And the kids, expectedly, they say, nah, I don't think we really want to do that. But Ahmed, pretty persistent. And that's going to end chapter 18. That was a real quick one, just putting people in coffins. Dump, 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 chapter 19.
Sari gets in the coffin. She's scared. Gabe is like, well, what am I supposed to do? Got to get in this coffin. And unfortunately, now there's two 12-year-olds in a small enclosed space together. And the smell, like, these are must be ripe children at this point. Like, they've got fear sweat. Like, it's been a long day. Like,
yeah. Probably already been a dead guy in this coffin. It's probably reused.
Yeah, there's that, too. Like, yeah. But Ahmed puts the lid on him because he knows how to keep children in one place, which is apparently keeping them in a coffin.
Well, you describe it as a small coffin or potentially a tight space. And sure, when you think coffin, you know, I think the same. It must be roomy, though. And we'll find out in a minute.
That's true.
But there's like, either that or it's got like some secret facilities within it.
Well, have you seen Last Crusade, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would think, remember the Knight's Tomb in the sewer in Vienna?
Boy, I don't remember that specifically.
Well, there's a tomb in there. I would say like, it's probably built for like a full-size person plus a couple feet. Yeah, I guess it could be pretty
okay.
Big.
All right. Well,
but you're right, because it does need to be big enough.
We'll get to it.
Anyway.
But it's apparently roomy. I'll say it's also dark in there. I'll say it's dark, so maybe that adds to the size. But
they're just in that darkness. And again, there's bugs. And there's nothing you can do about the bugs when you're just lying in a coffin in the dark.
You know what kind of unsettled me, though, was Gabe getting in. Sari getting in was kind of like, that was weird because she gets to show that she's timid first. Gabe makes no effort to not get in the coffin. And it's like, imagine just, your Uncle Ben's already down, your savior's gone, no one else knows you're down there. You get in that coffin, that's it.
That's true. He's basically, yeah.
He's kind of given up.
It's kind of like that unwritten thing where it's just like, he's given up. Like, yeah. That's it.
Like this.
Like, it's not quite saying like laying down and dying, but it kind
of
is.
Like, you know, if you take this out of the context of a children's book where we don't know how it could end, I'm thinking this kid just killed himself. Or at least is going along with his death.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he's in there. He's in the coffin. Pretty messed up. Ahmed slides the lid over the top of them. It's dark in there. Sari tells Gabe, you know, she's scared. And then immediately fusses at Gabe for telling her how her brains were about to be removed in a mummified way. Which is kind of, maybe that's her lighthearted way of giving Gabe some props in some weird way. Like,
no, don't give her any.
It's kind of like her only way of being like, I wish you didn't know more than me about that one thing, because it's all I can think about.
I think she's just a trash monster.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
To be fair, at least the first step is immediately scrambling your brains. The whole, like, being mummified alive kind of stops there.
Yeah, sure does.
Like, once they jam a spoon in your brain and start swirling around, there's no nerve endings in your brain, you know. You can't actually feel pain.
Is that right?
It probably feels weird. Yeah.
Interesting.
Your brain can't feel pain itself.
Huh.
But instead it feels the pain of the rest of your body. So
thanks, brain.
It sacrificed itself.
Yeah, thanks. Well, you know, they can't think of anything to do. They're like, well, we're in here. We got a lid on us.
Did they even try? And like, no. Together, two burly 12-year-olds could probably move that coffin.
You think?
Sari put herself in a coffin.
Yeah.
Like, was that made of paper mache? Like,
well, I mean, it even talks about how Uncle Ben was put in a coffin and they think he might have put something on the lid. Do I remember that? That Ahmed put something on the lid to keep him from getting out? So,
well, Uncle Ben's a big guy, though, so Uncle Ben could probably just one hand that. So that makes sense.
So I don't know. Maybe Ahmed did the same and covered their lid with something heavy. But they hear a sound and realize that, you know, at first they're like, what is that noise? What's it's like a weird scraping sound. They sense movement around them. Is it bugs? But then they sense that something inside the coffin that they're in is also moving. Dum, dum, dum!
This is where it gets a little like, I don't think the space is working anymore. But it's Uncle Ben. He's in the coffin with them now. There's escape hatches, apparently, in coffins to get out of them. So I don't know if that the whole trapdoors in coffins was a thing. However, I think the way that the ancient Egyptians conceptualized death is the fact that the physical body was still important in the afterlife, as opposed to modern thinking about that kind of thing, where it's your spirit, whatever. I could go on to that if you want and talk about the afterlife and how that the beliefs about the afterlife evolved.
Or we don't have to do that. Just up to you.
Okay, that's true. So anyway, but Uncle Ben has found basically a trap, a way to escape from his coffin and get into their coffin. And I guess they're listening for Ahmed if he's there, but they think he's skedaddled. So they bust out of that their stone sarcophagus, and they don't want to take the ladder because they think it'll take too long for all three of them to get out of there. And that's fair.
Seems fair.
You know,
yeah.
Probably all three of them trying to climb out of there. Yeah. And so they decide that they're gonna just book it, run down that tunnel, get out of there, home safe. Bump into Ahmed.
Oh, right into Ahmed.
Whose family probably helped build this tomb. So there's a guy who's going to wreck their day, it's Ahmed. He knows.
Yeah.
This is the family home, the homestead. This is where he grew up. He used to play, slide down the side of the pyramid as a child.
I just wonder where Ahmed went, you know? Like, he had his prey right
he
there.
He just had a whiz.
You think he had to go whiz?
He can't pee in that. Could you imagine if he tried to pee inside of Princess Kala's tomb? Like, they're not allowed to walk into the tomb without death.
Yeah, but what's he got to do? Does he have to kill himself?
He's allowed to, like...
He's the only one that can enact the curses.
Yeah, he'll have to mummify himself. Huh. I actually wrote a story where a woman embalms herself alive.
Hmm. I'd like to read that.
I don't think you would. It's very gross.
Oh, please. Send it to, you know my email.
It's like a modern fairy tale where she's like Sleeping Beauty, and then a cop finds her, and he's like Prince Charming.
Folks, if you would like this story, please email the show. We got Goosebumps Podcast at Gmail.
Oh, this is going to be cut. That story is not publishable. It is vile.
And Dylan will send it.
There's necrophilia in it, man. That's, well, it's implied. It doesn't actually happen. Ahmed, I guess he's feeling a little bit lazy because he's like, you know what? I don't really want to do the whole brain story thing today. So I'm just going to check you in the tar. I'm going to just put you right into the tar. And I'm assuming that boiling tar isn't great. And so he's taking him back to the prep chamber and he's going to, you know what? I'm even too lazy to push you in or any of that. Just jump. I just need one of you right after the other. Just hop out in there. And take care of business. But,
yeah.
Gabe, you know what? He's got some other ideas. No, he doesn't. He has no ideas. His one plan at this point is to be like, you know what? It's been a while since we've mentioned this, but I've got this ancient mummy hand in my back pocket called the Summoner that I bought for $2.
Yes.
At a yard sale from a small child.
He says, I spun around quickly and I held the mummy hand up high. I can't really explain what was going through my mind. I was so terrified, so overwhelmed with fear, that I was thinking 100 things at once. Maybe I thought the mummy hand would distract Ahmed, or interest him, or confuse him, or frighten him. Maybe I was just stalling for time. Or maybe I was unconsciously remembering the legend behind the hand that the kid at the garage sale had told me. The legend of why it was called the Summoner. How it was used to call up ancient souls and spirits. Or maybe I wasn't thinking anything at all. But I spun around and, gripping it by its slender wrist, held the mummy hand up high and waited. Ahmet stared at it. But nothing happened.
Dum dum dum!
Man, a lot of build up there. I thought we were going to get somewhere, Dill.
I guess not. Well, you know what? Turns out there's a reason why it's called the Summoner. It's not really summoning them, right? Like, they're already there. They're already, anyway, the mummies start coming
alive.
It's kind
of like a reanimator, right?
Yeah. I mean, a child named it. I bet you that kid at the yard sale is just like, yeah, it's called the Summoner. It's not just like your average monkey's paw situation. Like, this is a named item. Like, this is a collectible. So listen, got all five fingers. Nothing's broken off. It's the Summoner. Got a number 541 out of 1,000. Not bad. $2.
$2. That's not bad. I mean, he sold me on it and I wasn't even in line for it.
And I mean, it only does good, but the mummies, they're coming alive. They and you know what? Not only are they coming alive, but some of them were made by Ahmet, one or two of them, or by Ahmet's family. And I feel like it's not that they're doing Gabe's will, but they're just like, oh, this asshole. And so they go straight for Ahmet.
Yep. It's pretty awesome.
And Gabe has got his army of the undead, and they're about to throw him into the fire. Ahmet, not Gabe. Gabe is king right now. And, but Ahmet, I guess, decides that he wants a sequel to The Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, and he books it out of there, and he safely gets away, which is interesting, because Spidey didn't get that same, treatment. Neither did Sabrina.
Right.
But I guess Ahmet, is allowed to live another day. To be fair, he's protecting a cultural heritage site from outsiders.
That's the moral high ground you're taking. You're like, well, he's protecting a monument.
R.L. Stein is the one who spared his life. So I'm just trying to explain why.
All right. You're right, though. Spidey got dead, didn't he?
Mm. Oh, yeah. He died of a heart attack.
Huh.
Well, you had to endure a 5-minute monologue while I debated whether or not the camera killed him or if his own failing heart system killed him. And then at what point do you blame the camera? Anyway, I'm not going to do that
again. Here,
this is a whole new thing.
Ahmed's atrocities are much more direct. He tried to kidnap and murder children.
Yeah.
Fact. But still.
Yeah, but they also... Listen, his religion is real. Like, 100%. Those mummies came alive. So, if he says they defiled the tomb, maybe they did. You know? I'm just saying. He's got 4,000 years of a pension plan and a long line of business that show that he's in the right, and they're just coming and just interrupt it. Like,
no. Yeah, no, I get it. So he gets free.
Why am I defending him?
I don't know.
Why did you put me in the position where I'm defending him? I'm not the one that didn't kill him at the end of the book like you should for a Disney villain.
You just took that position. I'm just over here. So Gabe is still holding the Summoner above his head. Like, he just kind of left it there. I think he was kind of stunned by what happened and just didn't move. So then when he lowers it, he realizes that, now all the mummies return to their original poses. So he understands, you know, how the Summoner sort of had that power over all the mummies. And he's like, dang, $2. Best $2 I've ever spent. And then Uncle Ben drops this line. This is the line of the book, Dylan. You ready for this? Uncle Ben says, hey, thanks for the helping hand.
Uncle Ben. great uncle, terrible dad. Ugh. Like, that is exactly what an uncle should say in that situation. Meanwhile, his only daughter is in shock now. And a pun is probably not what he should be doing. But his nephew? Probably high five.
Yeah, high five. And sorry, may never be the same. And I'm on the fence about whether
especially
or not I care.
Especially not after what happens in the hotel room.
Yeah, back at the hotel, Gabe teasing her with the hand. And then Dylan, there's a knock at the door. You know, we're playing with this hand that just brought undead that have been dead for thousands of years back to life. Why would you just play with that thing? I don't know that I would ever play with
it. Why does he still have it? At one point, Uncle Ben is like, this is an actual artifact of great power. Here you go, small child.
Put it back in your pocket.
Like, again, like, this isn't even like an uncle thing. This is just like, your whole life is dedicated to these artifacts, and you're just giving it back to him? You've seen real magic. You have seen the dead walk. And you're just like, Gabe, keep it. And why are Gabe's parents letting him hold onto a hand?
A lot of issues. A lot of issues, Dylan.
But yeah, he's just waving it around, and he's even saying, like, before he wasn't even chanting in the tomb, but now he's just like, arise! Like, he's not just tempting fate, he is spitting in fate's eye.
What I was thinking the whole time, though, was that he was playing with it, was that somewhere down the pyramid, every time he raises it, all of the mummies get up and move around, and then he puts it back down, and they go sit back down. Like, he doesn't realize that he is animating them.
It really is just like a fucking Warner Brothers cartoon, where you just see them, like, sitting and just repeatedly, ugh. And then finally, after he does it 17 times, a mummy walks in from off screen and takes it away from him. That's what happens.
Yeah. Well, as a bug, there is a knock at the door, though, that he's playing with his hand. Now, could it be the mummies have now shown up? They're like, someone call with the hand? Or maybe it's Ahmed. I mean, it's not like they changed hotel rooms. He might know where they are. Huh? And he's on the loose. And he already tried to kill and murder them twice. Or kidnap and murder them. So, I mean, I don't know why he'd still be there. Go back to Uncle Ben's house. Well, I guess they know where he lives, too. There's no safe place in Cairo. Everyone should leave. So, anyway, who's at the door? Who could it be? You know, and let's stop. Not yet. Because you remember, there have been a couple of these that have ended with a bit of a loose end. You know? I keep thinking about the ending of Stay Out of the Basement, maybe one of my favorite endings so far, with the little plant screaming. You know? At the end, that was great. You know? And then there's a bit of ambiguity with the twins at the end of Say Cheese and Jai. Here, this knock at the door, it could go 100 different ways.
Especially since every time this door has been knocked on in the past, it's not been good. First, it's Uncle Ben, dressed as a mummy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then it was...
Oh, wait. I don't think there was a middle time.
And then it was just Uncle Ben, dressed as Uncle Ben.
But it's their parents. It's Gabe's parents. It's mom and dad.
They're back.
They've sold the Frigidaire. They can... We can all go home. And, yeah.
That's it.
It's funny because I didn't hear that part in the audiobook, so I thought, this is where I thought the book ended. I slowly lowered the hand as the door swung open. Two shadowy figures lumbered into the room. Thank you for reading Audible. That's all I heard. I didn't hear the last three sentences, so I literally thought the book ended on,
Oh, you thought it was a big cliff?
On, two shadowy figures lumbering into the room.
Wow. So what have you been thinking this whole time?
So I actually liked the ending of the book a lot more until just now.
Oh, wow. No, it was just Mom and Dad. Just Mom and Pa. They're back. Everybody's happy in this one. Just Ahmed's on the loose. Will he return in another Goosebumps novel later on down the road? I doubt it. But he could. He's a wanted felon. So, what did you think? Tell me.
I have issues with this book. And it's weird because I also think it's a very dense book. Like, there's a lot more going on in this book than there is in most, like, the other four that we've read. Like, especially compared to Stay Out of the Basement, which was literally up the stairs, down the stairs, up the stairs, down the stairs. This is like, they go to the pyramid. They go on a trip down to the museum and get kidnapped and have to run through an Egyptian bazaar. And then they have to go back to the pyramid and there's a thunderstorm. Like, it feels like a very dense and textured story. And it is... it just doesn't work for me for two big reasons. One, sorry, and Uncle Ben... I can't stand that kind of character anyway, like Sari, who is just in... She has a couple of moments where she's not a complete ass, but for the most part, she's unforgivably obnoxious. Like, every point where she's just like, oh, Gabe, you ruined everything. Gabe, you're such a coward that you want help in this dangerous situation. It's all this kind of stuff that makes it hard. And then it's the fact that I just don't care about mummies as a monster. It's a zombie that's tied up. Like, it's just, on a base level, you're already starting with a not very scary monster. which is a zombie or an undead ghoul or something. But now this one is also hindered by the fact that it's covered in bandages. And most mummies are wrapped around their legs, too. So, like, they wouldn't even be able to get out. And how do they untie themselves? They don't have working fingers.
I can see you're upset.
I feel like, in terms of the overall narrative, it probably had the most interesting structure. But the pacing felt too long. The fact that a couple of times very stupid decisions had to be made in order for the story to keep going. Like, Uncle Ben is criminally negligent to his children. or his child.
Yeah. Oh, both. Like, anybody.
Like, honestly, that's the whole thing I was thinking. It's just like, I really hope, like, CPS takes Sari away from Uncle Ben at some point, because something's wrong in that situation. I don't like that situation. But that's just me. So I'm coming down on it pretty hard. And it's partially being disappointed, and also I got the low blow at the end, where I thought it ended in a more dramatic way than it actually did.
I hear you. You know, my sentiments aren't too far separated from yours. I'll try to keep it concise because poor Dylan has had to edit out several of my coughing fits, and it seems that toward the end of this episode, I've not been able to speak many words without breaking into a full-fledged coughing fit. So, I agree about the mummies. They're not really scary things to me. They are interesting. They're not scary. Thankfully, though, the mummies aren't really the scare factor here. They actually fight for us. I think R.L. Stine kind of, like you said, they're not, you know, they're kind of hamstrung by what they are. They're just zombies wrapped in toilet paper. So he didn't really use them against us. He used them for us, which is nice. I didn't like any of the characters in the book. I thought Gabe was maybe even too relatable to me, which annoyed me. I was like, be more brave.
Yeah.
Sari, you know, Sari's not an unreal character. I think she represents a lot of kids that I knew and grew up with. And adults that I know. So I do hate her, and I think that's a testament to how well she's written. It just doesn't seem like she was a good match for Uncle Ben. I don't know, Uncle Ben was kind of fun. You just shouldn't be around kids.
Yeah, but I think the problem with Sari is that she's indulged.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's why she's such a problem. And, like, all the ways that she... Gabe really doesn't like her are things that Uncle Ben loves. Like, he loves the pranks,
yeah,
and he doesn't see anything wrong with those. So she'll keep doing that because he keeps rewarding it. But yeah, it's to me, I don't mind the fact that the lack of a supernatural doesn't hit until the end. That's actually a fairly common trope in, like, the old horror comics of, like, the 40s and 50s, and I'm assuming R.L. Stine read some of, like, the EC Horror and Creepshow, and that idea of just, like, oh, everything is normal and it's despicable people who get their comeuppance through, like, some sort of supernatural means by the end of the book. So it's an old standby in this, like, a horror convention, which I enjoy. And also, the thing is, though, I was so much more interested in the summoner. Like, the whole story behind where did the first kid get this thing?
That's kind,
like,
of a mystery,
and,
right?
The story I was telling in my head is, like, was more interesting to me than what was happening to the first group. Like, it was, like, the kid's dad in the army, because that happens a lot in horror stories, and he found something overseas, and he never came back, but his footlocker did, and that's the only, you know, it's stuff like that where it's just, there's something, where did this thing come from? How did it get to this, wherever, I think they live in Illinois or Chicago or something. Like, how did it get to the United States and get sold for $2?
Yeah. And another thing that, you know, for me personally, that this book didn't hit on is just, it's not that relatable for a kid. Like, I think it's cool that we got to take a trip outside the U.S. and be around pyramids. And that's how he was, you know, mummies were sort of a hot topic in that, you know, the 90s, it seemed like mummies were kind of a bigger deal for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think some of that just didn't hit me. And that's why some of the others stoke a little bit more of a feeling, is because I can relate to a lot of the environments. And here it was just, you know, It's like going to a museum and getting lost is kind of what it felt like.
Yeah.
So all of that said, I think I'm with you. I'm not a huge fan of the cover. It did, there, other than a few choice excerpts that we read that I thought were well written, I didn't really care so much for the story all that much. So all that to end, I think I'm going to end up giving this one, Dylan, 2 out of 7 coffins full of dead uncles.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm going to say 3 out of 5 sarcophagi, but all 3 of them are empty. That's how it feels to me.
So that's
no, it's just like, I feel like
that's like a layered rating system. Like if they were full, that's still 3 out of 5. But now that they're empty, is that just
point? It's hollow. It's hollow because that's what's really like, I don't think it's badly written. It just doesn't speak to me on almost any level. Like, so it's 3 out of 5, which is average, but it's hollow to me.
Okay.
Man. There's no scary mummies. There's no scary mummies in there. There's no scorpions. They're just...
There was scorpions.
They're empty, and that makes me sad. I want there to be monsters in those
There were scorpions. The scorpions part was the best part.
Yeah, but instead, it's just 3 empty sarcophagi.
Okay.
Like, I feel like I would have watched an episode of Forensic Files and had a more exhilarating tale of child napping.
That's a different podcast.
Probably would have ended on a more of a bummer note, but like, you know, at least it would have been interesting.
Our Forensic Files podcast will be of a different flavor. We'll save that for later.
Just reviewing Forensic Files. It's like, oh my God, remember when they were so into like a byte data? Like, what a bunch of BS. Blood splatter analysis, overused.
Overused, overruled. All right. Well, I think that's going to wrap us up.
Oh,
I totally meant to say that. That's my joke. That was a pun intended, I say. Yep. That'll wrap us up here like a mummy. And, you know, we have more books to come. You know, they're not all winners, and that's okay. But folks, if you liked what you just heard, even if you didn't, or you just want to holler at us, Share the time that you went to Egypt or the time that you got lost in a pyramid or your experience with mummies. We'd love to hear your anecdotes, please. We might do a bonus episode if we get enough emails of spooks from when you were a kid or your times reading these books. Maybe we'll do a little bonus ep encompassing all that. So please email the show. We got goosebumpspodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.
And you can also find us on Twitter @saycheeseandpod. I'm sure we'll be fairly active on Twitter. We're still fairly active on Twitter, so reach out to us there as well. And again, that is Say Cheese and Pod on Twitter.
All right. And you can also support the show, our whole network of shows you can support, by heading on over to patreon.com/polykill and finding a tier that works for you there. And you will be supporting the other shows in our network, like our movie podcast, Uncle Doug's DVD Bin. We have a few video gaming podcasts, like, of course, Polykill, Drunk Friend, and Tales of the Lesser Medium, and a few other new podcasts that are on the way that may already actually exist as the time that you hear this, but can't name them just yet. It's weird how things release. But pop over there, check it out. And now, Dylan will read us the back of the book. Take it away.
On Max's birthday, he finds a sort of magic mirror in the attic. It can make him become invisible. So Max and his friends start playing Now You See Me, Now You Don't, until Max realizes that he's losing control, staying invisible a little too long, having a harder and harder time coming back. Getting invisible is turning into a very dangerous game. The next time Max gets invisible, will it be forever?